You can now hear Film Actually on Stitcher Radio. Stitcher allows you to listen to your favorite shows directly on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or WebOS device. The latest episode is always available for you. No syncing needed, no memory wasted. Don't have Stitcher? Download it for free today at Stitcher.com.
What do you know about the Deathly Hallows?
It is rumored there are three. The Elder Wand, the Cloak of Invisibility, to hide you from your enemies, and the Resurrection Stone, to bring back loved ones from the dead. Together, they make one the Master of Death. But few truly believe that such objects exist.
Do you? Do you believe they exist, sir?
I see no reason to put stock into an old wife's tale.
You're lying. You know one exists. You told him about it. You told him about the Elder Wand and where he could go looking for it.
It'll be much less terrifying if you just come to me.
Wolfman's got hair!
Make love in a hammock.
What?
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Film Actually, episode 139 for the 16th of July, 2011. I am David McVeigh. I am joined in studio by Josh Philpott. How are you, Josh?
Fantastic.
Really? That's just so unusual for you.
I've had food. I've had drink. I'm feeling, slightly buzzy and up. We had a good geek show.
We had a great geek show. And that other voice you're hearing muttering in the background over there is the return of Richard Gray. How are you, Richard?
I'm peachy.
You're peachy. So we're having the Battle of the Beards again, except Josh is outclassed.
You cannot win against us this time.
Yeah. I saved off so that I can come back later and beat you all.
We want a real man mountain beard. We went down to your...
Real Grizzly Adams.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so this is Film Actually, the official movie podcast of the Geek Actually Network. This week, we are going to review the final film in the Harry Potter series, Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows, Part 2. Plus, we have a little bit of film news, including some brand new trailers for The Adventures of Tintin and Sherlock Holmes' Game of Shadows. So we've got some good stuff happening there. There have actually been a lot of trailers this week. We didn't put them all in the show because there are too many. There are two that are going up on the site this week. I just haven't had time to put them up, but you've got them on your site already, Richard.
I do, on the realbits.com.
So if you go to realbits.com, you can catch them out. And that is the prequel / remake / redo / reimagining of The Thing. And John Carter has also come out this week. And we'll talk a little bit about John Carter, I think, probably during the show. Yeah. I don't actually have official stories about it, but I think we should just at least talk about it because it really, we also have a brand new list of five this week. Because it's Harry Potter week, we're going to do five fantastic fantasy films.
Oh, that's some good alliteration right there.
I thought so. Yeah. But first, let's do some feedback. Forgot to bring my feedback to the front. Now, we have some feedback here. Where is it? Oh, yeah, here we go. Now, I thought I read this last week, but Josh tells me I didn't, and we really do have to. This is from our friend Mike from Canada. And he says, "Hey, Dave, and then Josh." That's right. I wrote Dave first. That is because, Josh, I'm fuming with your review last show. Sir, where do you get off thinking that you are above this film? Your opinion was wrong, and the sound of your voice reminded me of the feeling I got when I watched the trailer for In the Name of the King. I didn't even watch that movie, but I might now. I hope you are happy, Josh, because I am not. You did this to me. Damn you all to hell. Just kidding. I'm in Thailand, and I haven't even listened to you.
Oh, thank Christ, because I was like, what? I don't even remember what I did last week.
He says, "Too bad I'm stuck on another flight tomorrow. Josh, please don't be mad. And Dave, I would only put your name first in a joke feedback." He says, "Have a great day, Mike from Canada in Thailand."
Dude, that was fantastic.
And he follows that up.
Because I, like, honestly, the problem with having a really short memory is people get angry about stuff I've actually genuinely already forgotten about. Like, that was a terrible review, and I'm just looking at them like, what did I say last week? Who was it?
I wrote back to him and said that was just fantastic. I can't wait to read that. And of course, then I got sick and I couldn't read it on last week's show. But he did write back and say he just loves being part of the show. He forgot to make fun of his list of five. Your list of five? In his email. Right. And he says if he thinks this bit was funny, that he could do it again and tear into your list.
All right.
I said, that's fine. But he also wrote to us again this week.
Yeah.
And says, hey, Josh, Dave, and the dude from The Real Bits, whose name I forget.
You can make up whatever you want. It's Richard, but I'll answer to a variety of things.
Call me Shirley if you like.
He says, first off, finally caught the last show and should not have said I was joking because, Josh, you were wrong.
Great. That's fantastic.
So
I'm wrong.
He says, so very, very wrong. we're talking Sean Connery, League of Extraordinary Gentlemen.
There's some things you say that you can't take.
Yeah, he says, by this I mean you wonder what the hell they were thinking. Wait, doesn't matter. What, I haven't watched this movie yet.
What movie was it?
I have no idea. I think he's joking again. All right, he said, heard rumors.
You confuse me with your thoughts and...
Now, he does go on to say, heard rumors that they are making a fourth Transformers with Jason Statham. I've heard this rumor, too.
Oh, wow.
I've heard this rumor, too. Yes. I think it would be awesome. It would
be a bloody good film.
I think it would be awesome. I think in order to save the franchise, they should have only two plots, and where the robots are just fighting in the movie over something, or they are attacking one of the four. For those who are listening to audio... Josh is going under the desk on Richard for some reason. I'm not entirely sure why. There's something in the air
in
the studio today.
My laptop is running out of power, Dave.
Ah, is that what it is? That's your excuse.
I didn't realize I needed them, but all right.
He says, anyway, goes on and on about, you know, random robot fighting and stuff. He goes, the other plot would have Statham and a new Autobot racing to get something. This keeps the movie simple and makes it more of a buddy cop movie. Just like Knight Rider, it says.
You know what? It's still a better plot than anything Michael Bay could come up with.
Now, I'm going to read this next sentence exactly as written. And, Mike, I apologize if it sounds like I'm making fun of you, but I am. But I don't understand the sentence. It says, just watch The Hulk and remember the first time Note turned into Absorbing Man, I said out loud, holy shit. Absorbing. Is English your first language, Mike? That's
something Absorbing Man. No, sorry, I didn't.
No, yeah. I don't understand the sentence.
I missed that.
If you can, like... help us out with that one. Didn't see that coming.
Translation. We need a mic translation.
He said, didn't see that coming. I didn't see that sentence coming, quite frankly. Perhaps you guys should do a list of five holy shit moments, which I think is a great list. Yeah. And also, he says, perhaps a genre-bending list combining films like Cowboys and Aliens. Yes, that is definitely nice. Coming. Yeah, a genre-bending list is definitely coming. Glad you're feeling better. Take care. Sorry about the long email, but I figured you missed last week, so I should go on.
It's an awkwardness now.
Now, he also wrote one more. Mike's been very busy this week. Apparently nobody responded to our Transformers giveaway.
Right.
2 weeks they've had because we didn't put a closing date on it. So we're going to offer it one more time.
Mm. Right.
Same thing. Tell us what you liked about Transformers 2. Okay. This time
that's the problem. That's why that one.
I knew that one was going to stun everyone.
All right. Let's make it simpler. Tell us what you really. Excuse me. Tell us what you really didn't like about Transformers.
Come on, that's so easy.
I know, but
we got to get
rid of this disc, man. All right, openly open
you
to
really
the Australians because it is a Region 4 and we're cheap. We don't want to send overseas. So please, we have this copy. We'll send it out to you straight away. Send your email to feedback@filmactually.com. Mike, however, did do an entry, but as we always know, Mike is disqualified because he's in Canada or Thailand or somewhere in the world.
I'm sorry.
But his one was, best thing about Transformers 2 is that my wife paid for the tickets.
Yep.
I like it, dude. I like it.
Nice. Beat that Planet Earth, Mike from Canada. There you go. All right. So that entry, unfortunately, is disqualified because he's in Canada. We have one more. This is from Sandy from St. Louis, Missouri, USA. Now, nice. I believe this is the first from Sandy. And says, hey, guys, love the show, but totally disagree with your review of Transformers 3. I want this movie... I think this movie was so much better than the second one. There were no racist robots or robots with balls, and the story made some sense.
Even though
it was a very thin plot. Like you guys, I love the action scenes and could watch The Last Battle in Chicago over and over again. However, I also enjoyed Shia's nervous twitch acting and his rants. The interview montage of him ranting at Bumblebee for not revisiting were hilarious. I also enjoyed Frances McDormand's character and wish she had a bigger role. Overall, I only have two complaints with the movie. First, I wish Sam's parents were in the movie more. Oh, God. Because they have such great comedic chemistry between the two of them. Secondly, I hated the slow shot with Carly near the end of the film. I think we can all agree on that.
No, I thought it was fantastic.
It did nothing and was just weird. I would recommend this to anyone who wants to see a good summer action flick. Sandy. Okay, Sandy. Yes, it is a big summer action flick. And yes, the masses are talking because the film is making a fortune. Mm-hmm. So, we just can only put our opinions out there. Josh actually agrees with you. He thought it was much better than the second. I thought it was pretty much the same shit.
Word.
But that's a whole different show. Go back and listen to the last episode and you can hear all about our opinions. But thank you so much for writing in. Mm. All right. Now, James from Melbourne would like to say about Carly, said, well, she sucked a lot of robot to get that shot. Right? So, and wow. It wouldn't surprise me.
So who says they weren't robot balls in that film?
That's true. And and the concept that there aren't racist robots in the film, I think, is actually not entirely true. We're just not the same racist robots.
I've just looked it up, though. You said Money Talks, $705 million worldwide.
There you go. Money Talks. So how much, what was the budget on that one? Do we know?
According to this, $195 million.
So it actually cost less than the second one.
Mm.
Wow. Cost less than the second one. I would have thought it was like 1.5
times. This is from Box Office Mojo.
Fairly reliable. Fairly reliable. All right. So, okay. Let's move on and say that that's our feedback and thank you very much. We also like to talk at this stage a little bit about what we've been watching throughout the week. Has anybody been watching anything interesting?
Hell yeah.
All right, Richard, kick us off.
I'll start off. We all saw Harry Potter this week, but I saw a bunch of films in the last couple of days. Last night, I saw a movie called Beauty Day, which those of you out there in the podcasting world will probably know the name of the director, and I'm just quickly looking it up now because I've forgotten already. It's Jay Cheel, who runs Film Junk.
Yep.
And this is the story of a... I saw this, actually, I should point out and give a big shout out to Possible Worlds, the Canadian Film Festival here in Sydney. Mm-hmm. And I was at their program launch last night. This is a film they gave us as a preview. This is the guy, Ralph, and I hope I'm pronouncing this right, Ralph of Zavadil, had a cable show in the early 90s in Canada. So right. Only Canadians would probably be familiar with him. And he was kind of like a...
If I know anything about Canadian TV, only Canadians would understand it.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, yes and no, because this guy...
Canadian television's pretty out there.
This was very out there. This guy was a proto version of the Jackass shows, like Johnny Knoxville and stuff. And he was just basically doing it to amuse himself. It opens with a shot, and you see the shot about 14 times throughout the movie, where he sets up this like 10-foot-high ladder against his fence... Because he didn't rope it off properly, and he roped it off with bungee cords instead, he was trying to jump in off this ladder into his pool. because he roped it off with bungee cords, the ladder snaps back, and he goes flying headfirst into the concrete next to the pool, breaks his neck, and that's where the film starts. And sort of goes back and talks about what led him to that moment. Dude's all right. He's just done a 20th anniversary show, but this movie's insane. It's kind of like, have you ever saw Anvil, the story of Anvil?
I never actually saw it. I really want to.
It's kind of got that sort of vibe to it. So that was great.
Anvil, the story of Anvil, is supposed to be excellent.
Yeah, it was really good, and it was really good. And it's a fascinating guy either way. So, you know, if you like Jackass, if you want to see something a bit earlier, it's kind of like, and what happened to him when networks started to get involved in things, it's kind of a little bit like that early 90s stuff. It's a little bit like Wayne's World, what happened to him. you can guess that this is the sort of stuff that Mike Myers would have been watching when he was in the early 90s in Canada. And then I also saw a couple of other films I'll mention quickly. So with David yesterday, The Lion King in 3D was awesome.
Really good. It was really good.
17 years old. Can you believe that?
Yeah,
17
years and old. And I've got to just say about the 3D conversion, really good. It should have been an absolutely no-brainer. We should have actually gone, it makes perfect sense, because it's all such very clearly defined line art. It's really easy to separate. Yeah. And so the 3D works really well.
Post-conversion's great. They did, because they actually scrubbed this movie up for IMAX back in 2002. So it's already looking good. I want to say that I went and saw Jodie Foster's Beaver this week, just so I can make that joke. I've already made it a million times on Twitter this week, so I won't go any further than that. Saying
we won't delve into
saying that Mel Gibson was in Jodie Foster's Beaver, and I can legitimately say I've seen Jodie Foster's Beaver now.
All right, enough.
And actually, really quickly, there's one other movie I saw this week, which is called The Conspirator. And I think it's already out in the States, but we're getting
I'm actually seeing that next week.
Yeah, so it's actually quite a good one. It's about the Lincoln assassination and the court case following it. James McAvoy, Professor X himself, is in it. So great performances, but I'll see what you think about it.
Yeah, I've got Josh and I are actually going to a media screening for that next week. So we'll talk more about that when we've actually all seen it. It looks interesting. It does.
It is interesting.
Looks very interesting. Josh, what have you been watching this week?
Honestly, man, no. It's been another week of gaming, which is also thankfully my it is my last week of gaming based medium only, because we've had a lot of games to knock through over a 2 week period.
It's been a big release time. So.
Exactly. We have nothing basically until end of this month now, so I'm going to be catching up on a whole bunch of movies. I bought, but haven't watched yet, the reconstructed version of Metropolis, which we haven't seen yet. We wanted to see it in the cinema, but it just never happened here. And yeah, so we missed out on that, but I now have it on Blu-ray with all the special features and all.
For those that don't know, we've talked about it on the show once, but it was actually about a year.
So you should already know.
Year and a half ago, we talked about it. The Metropolis was always missing about 20 minutes because in its original release back in 1920 something, they were shredded. It was cut. And over the years, I've actually thought that all that footage was lost. And recently, they found a complete print, and it was in pretty bad condition, but they found a complete print, and they'd already restored the film, and what they've done is they've gone through with that beautifully restored version they have, and they've cleaned up as best they can the missing parts from that print that they found, and they've managed to reconstruct the entire film. So there are sections in it that look really rough because they're from this really rough print, but it is the complete film now. So I am really curious to see the whole thing. So,
absolutely.
Fritz Lang's masterpiece. That and M.
M is it for
just,
me.
Just two amazing films. And I haven't seen M in years, but I've seen Metropolis many times. I used to have a copy of the restored version before that they found the missing footage.
This is
the definitive version. I really want to see this.
Yeah, Madman's put that one out here in Australia. So
yeah,
that'll be great.
Yeah, that'll be
on Blu-ray, no less. Which is
I can't wait. It's going to be fantastic. This week, I bought the Blu-rays of the Lord of the Rings extended cuts, and I've managed to power through two of them so far. They are a commitment in time. We were going to watch Return of the King last night, but unless you start early enough, you can't get through it because Return of the King is 4 hours long in its extended version. So we're going to start earlier tonight and actually try and get through the last one. But they look magnificent on Blu-ray.
So I had a few problems with the transfer on the theatrical cuts, so I'll be interested to see what the extended ones
look like. I didn't get the Blu-ray theatrical
cuts. I only got them because I review for a DVD website, and I got
that would be DVD Bits.
That would be DVD Bits, yes. I actually run DVD Bits. I just review for it. And I that's the only reason I got the theatrical cuts. It would be lovely to have them both in one package.
I think the theatrical cuts should be included on the Blu-rays for extended versions.
Am I right in thinking that these copies have got it's still split over two discs, and there's a DVD for the bonus features rather than the Blu-ray?
No, there's actually on the Blu-ray, it's all Blu-rays. It's all Blu-rays as far as I can tell. And what they've done is they've released the 4-disc Blu-ray extended set that was originally released on DVD as 4 Blu-ray discs.
Right.
And then there's a 5th disc in the box, which is the documentary by Botha that was put on the re-released the re-release DVDs of Lord of the Rings, which is a separate documentary again. So that's on another disc. So each disc, so the extended cut is 3 boxes, and in each box is 5 discs.
I'll have to pick this up.
And it's got all the printed material in it. And it's a fantastic set. And the DVD, the Blu-ray transfer is amazing. When they cut across the map, there's that one sequence in Two Towers where they cut across, you can see all the grain in the paper of the map.
Lovely.
It's remarkable. It just looks fantastic.
It's a must buy.
So well worth having a look at. As I say, we powered through two of them. The only complaint I have is that the bonus features aren't in high def.
This is what I've heard.
So they're on Blu-ray discs,
but they probably wouldn't have been shot in high def. They
probably
shot
not
for video.
Yeah.
But
the Botha ones are actually even in 4x3. They're not even in widescreen. So it's like he's just had a handy cam. But his style of documentary was fly on the wall.
Yes.
And so basically, it's just him walking around, just talking to people,
absolutely,
and showing behind this. And so they're actually quite compelling. They're like an hour and a half long, and they're actually quite compelling. Just watching him talking to people and seeing people actually losing it. it. You know, it's interesting because it's like on all the other documentaries on the Lord of the Rings, it's all like we're a happy family, we're lit, and we're that. And on his documentary, you actually see at one point there's Peter Jackson on the phone calling the art department saying, can you write a memo for me, please, to the art department saying that I have to approve all things and his satchel is not acceptable? You know, and it's like, and my wife actually, my lovely wife Katie actually said, this is like the mean documentary. This is the one where they're all tired.
Yeah,
you know?
I'm totally getting that now.
So it's kind of, everybody seems grumpy throughout the entire thing. So it's really interesting to have a look at. Well worth the purchase price. It is a bit pricey. I think it's about it's $100, $119.
Oh, it's expensive.
Yeah.
I wonder if though in 2013 or 14 we'll get a box set that's got The Hobbit in there as well.
I kind of worry that what's going to happen is they're going to release some deluxe Blu-ray that's going to have the theatricals, the extendeds, all the documentaries, but that's The Hobbit. And that's the problem.
And it's also got the video where everyone's picking their nose at once. Yeah. They managed to find that footage and restore it. Yeah, no, I'm sick of this.
Yeah, I'm sick of it. It's like, release it once and be done with it, you know? Yeah. I think with The Hobbit coming out, and that's what, I was actually not going to buy Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 1. Not until Part 2 comes out on Blu-ray, because I wanted to see if they were going to do a combination film.
I've not bought any, and I'm waiting for the 8-film box set at the end. I'm absolutely, yeah. I've been thinking about it the whole time.
But I was given a copy for my birthday, so now I have it on Blu-ray. But so I wasn't actually going to buy it. I was going to hold off and see what happens after Part 2 comes out.
It'd be nice if they released that as one new cut film.
Just all you have to do is take the credit sequence out.
Absolutely.
And just bolt them together. Because
it's literally the same scene.
Yeah, because we'll talk about this in the review, but it literally picks up from the last frame of the Part 1. So there's no reason why you couldn't just combine the two together. And on that, let's actually get into this review, because what we're talking about this week is Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2. Now, for those who remember, for those who are keeping score, Josh and I and Celine reviewed Part 1, and Josh and Celine really didn't like Part 1 very much. I did. I thought it was okay, but I did say at the time, it is impossible to review a film that is only half a film. And I said, we reserve all judgment on Part 1 until Part 2 comes out, because then we can actually look at it as a film with a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Absolutely.
So today, not only are we looking at the film as the film that is released, but we also have to probably revisit a little bit of Part 1. Okay? So, all right. So with that, we say this is directed by David Yates, who has directed the last four. He directed Order of the Phoenix, Half-Blood Prince, and the two Deathly Hallows films. Written by Steve Kloves, Kloves, I think he pronounces it, who's actually written every Harry Potter film except Goblet of Fire. So not a bad effort. Based on the novel by J.K. Rowling, it stars Daniel Radcliffe, Rupert Grint, Emma Watson, Ralph Fiennes, Alan Rickman, Warwick Davis, Helena Bonham Carter, Ivana Lynch, Jason Isaacs, and it goes on. Basically, I've said it's just about every working actor in England at this point is in the Harry Potter films at some point or another. So Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2, this comes straight from Warner Brothers. And I think it's actually a terrible description, but it's the best one I could find. Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2 is the final adventure in the Harry Potter film series. The much-anticipated motion picture event is the second of two full-length parts. In the epic finale, the battle between the good and evil forces of the Wizarding World escalate into an all-out war. The stakes have never been higher and no one is safe, but it is Harry Potter who may be called upon to make the ultimate sacrifice as he draws closer to the climactic showdown with Lord Voldemort. It all ends here. Okay, that's official terrible. Synopsis. That is their official synopsis, and we'll stick with it, and I haven't changed media over,
notice that. Was going to bring that up.
What, that I hadn't changed media over? Yeah. Well, I have now, and here's the trailer for Harry Potter.
Harry, be safe. Be strong.
Harry Potter. You have fought valiantly. Now, join me and confront your fate.
Kept him alive so that he can die at the proper moment.
Bring him to me.
Let's find out where he is. If we find him, we can end this.
I say we jump now!
Hogwarts is threatened! Man the boundaries! Protect us!
I have to go back, haven't I?
It's a suicide.
suicide mission. The boy who lived. Come to die.
Tell them how it happened that night. How you looked him in the eye. A man who trusted you. And killed him.
I never wanted any of you to die for me. You'll stay with me.
Always.
Until the end.
No!
Oh, come on, Tom. Let's finish this the way we started it.
Together!
Righty then. Who wants to start us off? By the way, I just want to make a quick correction. Steve Clovis wrote all of the Harry Potter scripts except for Order of the Phoenix, not Goblet of Fire.
Right.
Order of the Phoenix was written by Michael Goldenberg. But yeah, so yeah, Steve Clovis had written all the other ones. And it was very interesting throughout the making of this. I mean, we went on, I think 2 weeks ago, we talked about this is quite an achievement in film, just doing 10 years worth of movies and so forth. We won't go into all that again. But the point is that when you think about it, Steve Clovis had an intimate relationship, not that kind of intimate relationship, but an intimate relationship with J.K. Rowling. And he knew all the ins and outs of what was coming, even on the unwritten books, because he had to be able to write films that would actually fit within that canon. And he actually said in an interview I read once where he said it wasn't that she would tell him what was going to happen, but she would say, oh no, you can't do that with that character. And it's like she would kind of manipulate what was going on because she knew what was coming. It was a very interesting relationship that they had. So all right, who wants to start us off?
That's a tough one. Who wants to be the first one to make a statement on a movie?
I'll make
like
a
this?
Statement. I actually really, really, really enjoyed this film. All right, so I'm a Harry Potter fan. I've read all the books. I've seen all the films numerous times. And I think that I had a really cathartic a moment with this film, basically saying this is it, we're finally finishing this off. I thought it was incredibly faithful to the finale of the book. I was actually really worried they were going to change the end a lot, because a lot of what happens in the book is actually kind of surreal, and they kept that surreal nature, things like the White Room and stuff like that. For those who've read the book, you know what I'm talking about. They kept that, and I actually thought they would cut that, because it is kind of, even reading it in the books, I thought this is really surreal, how would you film this? But they did keep it. I really liked that they did all of that, and they managed to and I think David Yates has actually done a really remarkable job, in the sense that he's managed to make a very action-packed film that also knew when to stop and deliver a moment of emotion and not feel overly cheesy with that emotion, but just give you enough that you went, that strikes me here in the heart, and we can then move on with the action again. He was giving closure to a lot of fans, and I think he did a really good job doing that. My biggest complaint with this film is it shouldn't have been split into two pieces.
No.
That is the, and that's the only complaint I can say about this, these two films combined, is it shouldn't have been split. I would, this part was 2 hours. The first part was 2 and a bit hours. I think if you had trimmed the first film,
if you had done a really good job of trimming,
trim the first. I don't think you need to trim much out of the second film, but if you trim the first film by 40 minutes, bolted the two together, you would have had a 3-hour Harry Potter film, which we've had before.
Absolutely.
So we're not adverse to having a long Potter. You know, the first and second ones were 2.5 hours long. So we could have done that, and we would have had this big 3-hour finale.
And then I wouldn't have had the problems that I did with the first one. Because realistically, my biggest problem with the first one is I don't care what you try and sell me, that film is the first half of something that was going to be good.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's my problem. It's like, one is a waste of time. It is, yes, it's story driven, and yes, it pushes the story in the right direction, but it's like, it goes back to that old kind of like early HBO kind of TV plot thing where it's kind of like, and cool stuff's going to happen next episode. It's like, no, I'm sorry.
Now, I watched part one literally the day before I went to see part two. So I was really fresh in my mind.
Yeah.
And all I could think was that in context with part two, part one is a much better film because the story building stuff makes sense to build to the conclusion that is in part two. The problem is that if you just have that story building stuff and then have no payoff, which is what part one did, you sit there going, why have I just watched 2 hours of these kids trudging through the forest?
And,
you know what I mean?
And realistically, if we hadn't have watched part one, part two would just be like, wait, what? What's going on?
That's right.
Like, it's just...
Yeah. Part one, it is important to note that part one is essential viewing for part two. You have to have the first half of the story.
The funny thing is, two has everything I wanted one to have a little bit of in it. That's the funny thing. It's like, it has action, it's really growing up, it's very, like, people die left, right, and center. People are getting killed off without even question, you know, which is fantastic. Story goes somewhere, great building of tension, brilliant battle scenes.
Effects work, guys.
Exactly.
This is just amazing stuff.
Look, I mean, the everything that you wanted is in this, but when you take it as its own film, if I'm going to take two as part two, as I'm supposed to do, no, well, you don't get full
And
points.
Look, David Yates has... David Yates hits the ground running in this film. He is expecting you to keep up. He expects you to have seen part one. He expects you to have seen Order of the Phoenix. He expects you to have seen Half-Blood Prince. Now, you'll get more out of this film if you've seen the whole series, but those are essential viewing. You really need to see his four films because he's into bringing back characters that he's introduced in his four films. Yeah. And he's... plot points that he started in Order of the Phoenix are now coming to resolution in this film. So you kind of need that backing of those films if you don't have that. But, you know, as my wife pointed out, when somebody actually made that criticism of this film, they actually said, this was actually a part one, where they said, oh boy, it's just like you have to have seen all these other films. She goes, it's part seven. What do you expect?
Yeah.
You know, it's like, keep up, right? So she was kind of defending it by basically saying, it's by the time you get to part seven, if you haven't seen any of the previous films, you really can't expect to understand what's going on.
No, and look, that's fine. I completely understand it from that. My only problem is the fact that this is split into two parts.
Yeah,
it's like,
me too.
Two is a great finish, but two is the second half of a great finish.
Yeah, and as I say, when I watch this in future viewings, I've seen part two twice now because I had to take a little geek to see it as well, but... And I've enjoyed it both times. I mean, it really packs an emotional punch. It really does work well. But for all future viewings of this film, when it comes out on Blu-ray, it'll always be watch part one, part two together. Mm. It'll always be a double feature because they are the same film. They are the beginning and the middle, and then this is the end. This is the third act to a film that started a year ago. Richard, what did you think?
Yeah, well, look, I think it's... interesting, because I take to the opposite point of view. I stopped reading the series after about the fourth book. I wasn't a huge fan of the books. Frankly, I didn't think they were very well written.
I
think there's a lot of waffle in those books. She needed a damn good editor from at least the second or third one onwards. I think that's when they stopped being edited because they just wanted to churn them out there and get them out there into the public. We're talking about books that have 100 pages worth of Quidditch match at the start. We get Quidditch. We know what it is. We understand that. When I was writing the review, I'll quickly jump in here to say that I actually really enjoyed this film because I'm not a fan of the series, and so I was pleasantly surprised when I got to this one. And when I was writing my review for it, I started making some of the obvious criticisms, like, oh well, pit characters just turn up and you don't know who they are because they come in to either die or to make a big speech or something. And then they kind of quickly shuffled off and you know, when they go on with another action sequence. And I thought, okay, well, that's kind of poor writing. But you're right. It's part eight, effectively. And, you know, these characters have literally grown up with these characters. This is the Luke Skywalker for this generation.
Oh, yeah,
for sure.
Absolutely.
So the emotional connection's already there. You don't have to reestablish the emotional connection in this film. It's there by virtue of the fact that we've lived with these characters for over a decade.
It's like, look, I mean, my problem is that if you start complaining about the fact that you don't know who characters are or whatever in this thing, look, I mean, I established that, but it's like coming into, one, two, or three of Star Wars and start going, well, why can that guy move things with his hands? It's like, realistically, there are certain things you just have to know.
Absolutely.
And it's like, if not, just take it for what you're seeing and go with it. And it's like, there will be reviews out there like that that don't watch the Harry Potter series. And that's just the way it's going to go. But realistically, I mean, I kind of push that stuff to the side when I'm reviewing something like this because it's like, David's wife is right. Like, realistically, yeah. You have to know by this stage. And if you don't, whatever.
But the beautiful thing of the Harry Potter series has been, and I did criticize J.K. Rowling's writing, but what she's effectively done there is she's done the classic hero's journey. Mm-hmm. And this is the classic hero's journey.
Oh, yeah.
Over 7 parts. And she's built this world of characters in there.
The other thing I've got to just throw in there really quickly about her writing, and the same thing can be said about the films as well, which is I actually really like the fact that her writing matured.
It does. It really does.
With her readers. Mm. So if you read the first Harry Potter, as in also watching the first Harry Potter film by Chris Columbus, they feel like a young adult kids novel and a young adult kids film. And as the films go on and as the books go on, as the characters get older, the tone gets darker.
Absolutely.
And I think that's a really clever thing with her, because what she basically did was she basically said, these books are coming out, you know, every couple of years, the kids are going to be this much older. And so she starts to introduce, like when Goblet of Fire came out, I remember there was such controversy over the fact that she killed one of the central characters. Yeah. And she actually said in an interview, at that age, kids are coming to terms with the fact that they're learning about death and they're learning about loss, you know? And this was basically how she integrated into... And it's funny because by the time you get to part 7...
It's a bloodbath.
It's a bloodbath. She's killing off... I mean, we're not even talking about the film, we're talking about the book. She's killing off characters right, left and center without even a moment's thought, you know?
And that was one problem I had, because if you're going... I mean, regardless of whether you got the connection or not, there are characters in that film that are being killed without a moment's thought. And there are some points where, you know, they're fighting the bad guys, and some of these guys die in pretty horrible ways, and it's never acknowledged. And these are kids.
They're not kids. They're 18-year-olds, you know?
Even so. You know, I mean, I know these are kids. I mean, and actually, a good analogy, these kids have literally gone through a war, if you want to draw that analogy.
Yeah.
And that makes you grow up pretty damn fast. But that said, I mean, I did find that if you take it in and of itself as a film... there are some obvious holes and there are some obvious things where you think, well, there could have been some more flesh detail here or whatever. But if you take it as it should be taken, part 8 or 7.5 of a cycle.
7.2.
HP 7.2, as we'll call it. It's a rousing conclusion. It's everything that you would want in that series. And me, as a non-fan, loved it.
Yeah.
You know? I had a small amount of my only criticism to this film is that I feel that
I'd have to read this in the chat room. James from Melbourne, if you're listening to the Geek Actually show before this, you'll know what he's talking about. He said that HP 7 is part 2 is like the Seaman cookbook, the best bits happen first.
James, go back and listen to Geek Actually episode 139 for references to what he's talking about. But anyway,
sorry Josh.
The only problem that I have is I feel that the ending conclusion just let me down a little. Like, it's sort of, they're happy, kind of like sending the next people off to the school thing. I was kind of like, oh, okay.
Oh, this is the epilogue at the
end.
Epilogue was actually heavily criticized in the book as well, though. A lot of people criticized. And in fact, on the second viewing of the film, I was sitting in a mainstream cinema with just a general audience with my wife and my son. And a girl behind me, when the screen comes up, for those who have read the book, you'll know what we're talking about, comes up and says, you know, 17 years later or whatever it is, it comes up. She actually... out of her mouth came, "I can't believe they put this part."
Yeah.
You know? So it's like even the people who've read the book go, the epilogue is a bit weak.
Yeah.
You know, it's always been a little bit of a weak epilogue, you know? But it's kind of necessary.
I actually think it's good because, I mean, you've got that in every other hero's journey type thing. Yeah, we watched The Lion King yesterday, as I said, and it's got the same ending effectively.
Yes.
It's the new generation starts, whether or not, you know, Warner's going to capitalize on that and make a...
Well, I hope they don't, because Rowling doesn't plan to.
No,
so.
She doesn't. And I just actually was looking at an article there where David Yates says he's not going to be involved in anything after that. Never say never.
Mm. Actually, I heard Yates is going on to... He's just signed to do Stand. Another...
Well, I've been reading two things, actually. He's either signed up to The Stand, which could be interesting, although it's been done...
He's done it as a miniseries.
I would love to see it as a film. I think it deserves
it. Although it has been
film.
Considered to be unfilmable he's, as a feature.
So. He's also been rumored to be attached to Fables.
That's the one I heard about,
Which Fables. Is the Vertigo, DC Comics Vertigo series, which should be a film. And if that was made, and we're doing our five fantastic
now,
fantasy
Yates,
films
for those who don't know where
Yates, time.
Those of you don't know where Yates came from, Yates actually directed the stellar miniseries State of Play, which was turned into a Russell Crowe film later. But the original British miniseries with I want to say Helen Mirren as the publisher.
Keep talking.
One of them is Bill. What is the film? Bill Nighy or Helen Mirren?
No, the oh god,
because it's one way or the other. Because the film either has Helen Mirren or both. In both cases, the editor is actually one of the best characters in it, and they're played by these.
So
great...
Bill Nighy's in the TV series along with James McAvoy, okay, Kelly great. MacDonald, yeah. John Sim, and David Morrissey.
So and you can get everyone. It on DVD in this country. You can pick it up, and you can pick it up fairly cheap. I picked it for like $15. It's like four parts or something like that. Mm. It's really, really fantastic. And when I heard that he was directing Harry Potter, I went, boy, this is a real change of pace for you. Mm. But he's handled himself really well in the fantasy arena. He's handled the big effects and everything else. And the thing about David Yates, though, and I think what's made his last four so successful, is the fact that he knows how to deal with drama. He knows how to pull his performances out of those kids, first of all. Because, I mean, when I saw Goblet of Fire, was probably the first step in when I really think Hermione is not a very good little actress. I mean, she was in Goblet of Fire, she was terrible, right? And she was fun as the little snooty girl in the first two. And then Goblet And then in Goblet of Fire, she's supposed to be trying to mature, and she was just flat and horrible. And then under Yates... in Order of the Phoenix, suddenly she developed into not a bad little actress.
In the last couple, she's been good.
And I thought, wow. And out of all the three leads, I think she has developed the most into being a really good little actress, you know? And it sounds so condescending in saying it that way.
But
you know?
I didn't feel there's any cringeworthy moments in the last chapter.
No, and that's a big factor. You know?
I mean, Radcliffe came off as a little stilted. And it surprised me because he's done such great theatre work and he's done other things where he's been quite... He hasn't done a lot of other film work. I think the only other film he's been in was December Boys, which is an Australian film.
Oh, that's right.
But I think he's one of the few that hasn't gone off and done much. Because,
well, and Emma Watson. Emma Watson, actually, a lot of people were speculating she'd never act again.
Oh, right. So she hasn't gone on.
But she has now. She's actually, she is, some stills have been surfacing on the net. She's in some indie film.
Because Rupert Grint's been quite busy the last couple of years. Yeah. Well, he did Thunderpants, but he also did... he was in a
Lest
movie.
We forget, Thunderpants. Yeah,
but he was also in a movie opposite Bill Nighy called Wild Target quite
loved
recently.
It. I watched it just the other day. Yeah. Actually, I really enjoyed that film. If you haven't seen Wild Target, Emily Blunt is out of her mind in that
we
film.
We love Emily Blunt.
We love Emily Blunt. She is so funny, and so is Bill Nighy. They're both really funny.
Bill Nighy's in everything, though, but he's always great.
Yeah, but as this uptight, obsessive, compulsive... almost OCD character who's falling in love but doesn't know how to deal with it is actually very amusing. So well worth having a look at. So as we were saying, Yates comes from this television background and I think he really understands performance. And this is why I'd be really curious to see what he does next, because like working with a comic book, for instance,
any of those would be great.
And even working with Stephen King, you work with paper thin characters.
Turning
those sort of characters into something more substantial.
In the case of Fables, they're characters that have been, developed over 60-odd issues or something, which is quite good. But there's just a wealth of different characters you can draw on. It'll be another ensemble piece. So it'll be interesting. He's obviously proven that he can deal with ensemble cast. He can deal with, as you said, with big special effects and tying all these different stories together.
I
would like... I mean, look, things like Vertigo comic series, I still want to see them as TV series. I don't want to see them as films.
Although I must say they did... I actually really enjoyed Constantine. I really enjoyed...
Constantine wasn't bad.
I really enjoyed what they did with that.
But that's a different kind of story. I think it lends itself to a film. Whereas something like Fables, something like Why the Last Man or
Why the Last Man has to be a miniseries.
Or Preacher would make a much better... Oh, if Preacher, they did Preacher, they'd have to do it as a couple of films.
Yeah.
If it managed to get released in mainstream.
But realistically, the other thing about Preacher, though, Josh and I have talked about this before, you don't need to do the whole series because the series actually falls apart in the second half. Yeah. You really only want to do the first half of it anyway.
Actually, and the ending is quite a good conclusion as well. So the start and the end, I think a lot of the middle stuff is just...
There's
filler.
A lot of junk.
Oh, there's a lot of... Yeah. It's a road movie. So you can cut it
A, it's a road movie, and B, it's kind of like morality tales, kind of like in a really sick, twisted, disturbing kind of a way. But it's like, if you knocked out a whole section, there is an ability to make it, but just there's so few people on earth I would trust with that concept.
We're off topic, but Garth Ennis is a great writer who creates great characters, but he hasn't really managed to sustain that anything
agree.
That he's done, including his Punisher work.
Sounds a little bit like Mark Millar as well. So they're kind of in the same boat.
But his characters are brilliant.
Great characters, great ideas, and he doesn't really have the through to carry it. That's why all of you, think about it, all of Mark Millar's best stuff is short. It's like Kick-Ass, 6 issues. But, you know, it's like, got to get through it quick because he loses focus.
Absolutely.
Anyway, all right, so let's wrap up Harry Potter and basically say, is it worth going to see?
Oh, look, I mean, I think at this point you're elbow deep in, you know. Yeah.
I got to say, man, I don't really think it's even a choice. I mean, it's one of the few movies.
See it, yeah.
Yeah, it's one of the few movies where I have to say it this bluntly and say, look, people will watch it whether or not we tell them to. I mean, like, realistically, if you've put in the time, you just want conclusion. It's all about conclusion now. It's just
David,
like,
and Margaret called it critic proof the other night.
Oh, it pretty much is. Yeah, no, yeah.
And totally agree. Yeah. It's one of those films where it's the few times where it doesn't matter what I say, but what I will say to people is it's worth the time.
Yeah.
It's worth the time investment to go in and just see it.
Yeah. Can I also point out, I'm bringing it up here, its Rotten Tomatoes score is staggering. Harry Potter at the moment, after it came out and it's now finally got all of its reviews, 214 reviews, 97% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Wow.
It's managed to hold its position for... It started at 100% with 20 reviews, and it only slipped by 3 points. That is a remarkable effort.
It's not doing quite as well on Metacritic.
What's Metacritic got?
87. About? It just disappeared, but it was 87.
Fair enough. And so, audiences on Rotten Tomatoes have given it 93%. So it's funny, the critics actually like it more than the audiences, which is intriguing. But the audience has a lot more ratings. The audience ratings on Rotten Tomatoes are from 16,000 entries.
And you'll have those people that don't like the series and have gone to see it.
Absolutely, yeah. But I think, look, quite frankly, if you're a Harry Potter fan, it is essential viewing. If you are not a Harry Potter fan, it is just a great action film. What have you guys found?
I'm still waiting to see Priest because, unlike the rest of the world, I don't want to pirate it. I actually want to see it at the cinema, and it's got a 41 on Metacritic. I'm like, wow.
I'll let you know if you don't want to pay to go and see it. Coming up soon on therealbits.com will be a competition to win double passes to see Priest.
Oh, there you go. And also, I'd like to point out the real Junkies actually reviewed Priest, and they said it was awful. They hated it.
I am just so excited to see how awful it is. I'm always looking for new entries to my worst films of all time.
I'm going to say, I recommend this film wholeheartedly, but only if you've seen part one, and realistically, you need to see the rest of the films as well. But I will say that part one is essential viewing.
Yeah.
Because it is just one film.
But only essential viewing because part two is a half-decent thing. It's like, if two wasn't good, I would never tell somebody to watch one.
No,
and I'm serious. Like,
but
I think
the thing I found on repeated viewings, because I've actually seen part one now on Blu-ray as well, it actually is a more bearable film because you're not stuck in a cinema seat and blah blah. Watching it at home, the pace of it is actually a very different experience because when you're at a cinema, you find that it slows right down and you start to feel your butt and so forth. But when you're stretched out on the couch watching it on TV, the pace doesn't really become an issue anymore. Yeah. And this is very much a case of a lot of films where extended TV viewing, you can actually sit there and go, this isn't so bad, you know? Mm. There's that cinema experience. And that's the thing that Peter Jackson said about the Lord of the Rings films. The reason why he did the extended cuts was he said, when you're at the cinema, you're not going to sit through 4 hours. No. And some of that stuff is just very slow-paced.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's story-building stuff. On DVD, you can always pause it, go make a cup of tea, come back, and so forth. So it's a very different experience to watch it. So yeah, grab the Blu-ray or DVD, watch part one, then go to the cinema, see part two. And part two makes part one a much better film.
Cool. Okay.
Yeah, so that's really the bottom line is it does make it a better film. So
cool.
All right, let's move on. We've got some entertainment news here. First of all, let's just go straight into this because I'm actually quite excited about this. Sherlock Holmes, Guy Ritchie's Sherlock Holmes, the Game of Shadows trailer came out this week, the first trailer. And I love the fact that they've kept exactly the same style as the first Sherlock Holmes, the same style of cutting, the same music and everything else. So let's just have a look at it and we'll have a chat about it. So here's Sherlock Holmes, the Game of Shadows.
Please sit. Put your money on the table. Welcome. The cards can illuminate your future. I have a feeling you're in danger.
Actually, I prefer to read your fortune. I see your next client is here to kill you. Oh, how I've missed you, Holmes. I see your web of conspiracy has expanded. I'm knee-deep in the single most important case of my career. The clues point in one direction.
Professor James Moriarty.
Are you sure you want to play this game? I'm afraid you'd lose. I agree it's not my best disguise, but I had to make do. You see this in the cards, did you? What are we doing down here? We are waiting.
I'm on my honeymoon!
Get that out of my face.
It's not in your face, it's in my hand.
Get what's in your hand out of my face.
Nice callback. All right, look, somebody in our chat room, Cal sent said, I want more episodes of the BBC TV series more than I want the new movie. Look, I want the BBC TV series as well, because that is fantastic. That retelling of Sherlock Holmes. But I also really enjoyed the first Sherlock Holmes films. I didn't think it was underrated. A great film. I actually said on the review, it's not a great film, but it was just pure entertainment.
It is. Look, a friend of mine, Sean Riley, if you ever listen to this, just I've given you a shout out, said that it didn't so much adapt Sherlock Holmes. It sort of caught the spirit of the books and then did its own thing with it. And I think for that,
it
did the Guy Ritchie thing with it. Yeah. And it's been so underrated as a result of it. They're fun.
It was a really fun film. Mm-hmm. And I remember I was really tired when I went to see it. And I remember sitting down in the cinema and I saw it with my mother. And I looked over at my mother and I said, all this film has to do is entertain me. Mm. At this point, it just has to entertain me. Mm. And it did, absolutely in spades, entertain me. You know, it was so much fun. The chemistry between Jude Law and Robert Downey Jr. was fantastic.
That was the best bit.
The visual look of the film, it was just a really fun film.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's holes in it and there's problems, but who cares at this point, you know? Mm. It was just an entertainment. And as an entertainment, it worked really well. And I'm really looking forward to the second one. I think the second one, it looks like they've kept the spirit.
Absolutely.
And that's all that matters.
And the fun, as I said.
And they didn't cast Brad Pitt, which was the rumor at one point that Brad Pitt was going to play Moriarty.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm so glad that they didn't go that direction. So, and look, it'll be nice to see Noomi Rapace doing something other than the girl with the dragon tattoo.
Yeah, yeah.
So
hopefully she's not as angry in this.
We also, there was another comment that I think we should mention. It was actually mentioned when we were in the what we were watching section, and I forgot to mention it at that point. But yes, I've heard this as well. Jurassic Park is on Blu-ray, October 26th.
Excellent.
I think this is going to be awesome because Spielberg's already said no changes to it. It is just Jurassic Park as Jurassic Park.
And I think we'll start seeing more Spielberg films because he was very reluctant to invest in DVD, I remember, originally.
Yeah.
And then once he did, they all came out. But we've already seen the magnificent Close Encounters Blu-ray, so hopefully this will be the same standard.
I have to buy that one still. I've got that really beautiful edition on DVD, which is the same version on Blu-ray with the book and the whole bit. Mm. And I just haven't invested in the Blu-ray
yet. I just picked
it
up. It was $13.
I'll go get it. That's, Close Encounters is one of my favorite films. So it's just an amazing film. And it looks so good even today.
Oh, yeah.
It's held up. All right. So thank you for that, Charlie Fat, for mentioning that. I'll buy the trilogy. I really only want the first film. But I'll buy the trilogy because I'm a completionist and I always buy everything in the series.
Yeah, so,
but I really just want the first film.
I mean, there's bits to like in the second one.
The second one has some really good dinosaur moments and stuff. Yeah. The problem I had with the second one is it has a really dumb ending.
It's dumb, but it's more moments than anything else. It's what Spielberg does really well, those kind of really...
The best thing in the second one, I think, is that sequence where she's laying on the glass and it's cracking.
Yeah,
that sequence is hands down brilliant piece of direction. Yeah. You know, it's just fantastic. It's
pure Spielberg.
Yes, absolutely. All right, what else we got for today? I think I've lost my show notes here. Hold on a second. Do I lost my show notes? Here Uncharted. We go. Oh, yeah, this is we have a new director writer for Uncharted. Now that it's funny because you always seem to be on the show when we talk Uncharted. Now that David O. Russell has finally walked and taken his script and everything else, Variety has talked that Neil Berger has been hired to write and direct the new Uncharted film. Now, what is he known for? Do we know?
Limitless.
That's Limitless. One. Yes, yeah. He was the writer director of Limitless.
Mm.
Now, I haven't seen Limitless.
Yeah,
I've seen Limitless,
but you have.
Yes.
Is he the right man for Uncharted?
They'd be very different films.
He doesn't have the greatest history of films. Like, no. Limitless is apparently quite good, but he also did The Illusionist.
Which was the other magic film that came out.
That was the one opposite. Prestige. Yeah.
And it was very obvious why people chose Prestige over it, because it's like, when I watched The Illusionist, I was like, yeah, it was all right, but it left me really cold. But again, I mean, the man's had really, you know, one hugely controlled movie, which was Limitless, and that was received quite well.
There is talk that if he does Uncharted, there is talk that Bradley Cooper may be cast as, because he has a relationship.
You know
with
what?
Cooper.
I could deal with that. Yeah. I wouldn't like it, but it's like, it's not the same feeling that I had for
Nathan Fillion. Mark
Wahlberg.
Yeah.
Because Mark Wahlberg is a complete wrong casting.
Yes.
Like, that's like casting a girl for a guy role. You know what I mean? Unless there's some weird thing that you don't know about this person, like, you know, what's a Cate Blanchett playing Bob Dylan? It's like, unless there's some weird thing, it's just not going to work. Mm. Like, and this was the case. It was like, we've all seen him act, we've seen him around for years, and when we heard about that, we were all like, nah, not at all. Just doesn't work, not even interested. However, I could deal with Bradley Cooper. I would much rather Nathan Fillion, but everybody seems to think he's too old, which I think is bullshit, because even he's in for it. And it's just so stupid.
If for some reason, Sony doesn't want him in it, because...
Really?
I mean, well, let's face it, Sony has ultimate say over this whole thing. They're producing the film, they own the game, you know? And it's like, so you sit there and you look at it and go, if all the fans are demanding it, why isn't Sony just saying, no matter who gets hired as a writer-director, Nathan Fillion is going to be in it? You know, for some reason, they're holding back.
Yeah.
Maybe they don't feel he's marketable enough, or...
He's got the geek crowd in his head.
Yes, but as we have proven many times before, geeks are not enough to sell tickets.
No.
We saw it with Scott Pilgrim. We saw it with Watchmen. These are both huge geek films. Geek cred out the wazoo, and they both failed at the box office. Geeks only account for some. There was actually a stat that came out after Watchmen. They said geeks only account for about $30 million at the box office.
Yeah,
really?
Yeah. So
we've got a number now.
Yeah, hardcore geeks really. Well, because you know what that number is based on: opening weekends of both of those.
Yeah,
films.
Absolutely.
<You know? laughs> So really, realistically, the geeks don't have the numbers. Not on a real solid geek property. You know, we need to get mass market appeal. Yeah. Mass market.
But the thing is, Uncharted should be a mass market film. It's the Indiana Jones film we haven't had in, you know, forever.
It's Indiana Jones film that should have been.
I like the comments in the chat room. James from Melbourne says, "Was you bold, is he?"
Oh, that's
Uwe Boll.
Sorry,
Uwe
Boll. I've forgotten my German.
I have a soft spot for Uwe Boll.
I don't. It's a hard black lump in the middle of my chest.
I have a soft spot for Uwe Boll. Anybody who can make films that bad and not get better, and make that many films and not get better. Come on, there's got to be something in there.
Or he possibly just saying he could just be a really shit director.
Oh, he doesn't care. He's about the money.
Yeah, that's fine, but it doesn't change the fact that he could be just a really shit director.
And with all of that being said, though, then he turns around and does something like Rampage, which is not a masterpiece, but was actually a better film for him. Mm. And you sit there and you look at it and go, why can't you do that every time?
Yeah.
There's something wrong with this equation. Yeah. All right, let's talk about Steven Soderbergh. We go from woeful to actually quite masterful. Steven Soderbergh's new film is a outbreak-style virus contagion film called Contagion. And this week they finally released, first of all, a little bit of a clip, and then literally 2 days later rolled a trailer out.
Mm.
And it looks fantastic. So I've got the trailer here. So let's have a look at this. This is Steven Soderbergh's new film.
It was a groundbreaking ceremony for a new factory. Did she mention seeing anyone who was sick? Anyone on a plane? The airport?
No. She said she was jet lagged.
The average person touches their face 3 to 5 times every waking minute. In between, we're touching doorknobs, water fountains, and each other.
Beth! Go up to your room, honey.
So we have a virus with no treatment protocol and no vaccine at this time.
You had a seizure this morning, Beth.
Do you have a history of seizures?
No.
Allergies?
As of last night, there were 32 cases.
Unfortunately, she did die.
Right. Can I go talk to her?
Mr. Amoff, your wife is dead.
What are you talking about?
Okay.
What happened to her? What happened to her?
Is there any way someone could weaponize the bird flu? Is that what we're looking at?
Someone doesn't have to weaponize the bird flu. The birds are doing that.
Watch this. It's transmission, so we just need to know which direction.
On day one, there were 2 people, and then 4, and then 16. In 3 months, it's 1 billion. That's where we're headed.
They're calling out the National Guard. They're moving the president underground.
People will panic.
Get away!
It will tip over.
The truth is being kept from the world.
Cook your samples. Destroy everything.
Hello. I need you to get me the names of everyone who serviced this room. It's an emergency.
You can't panic now.
I know.
I'm gonna get you home.
I got people too, Dr. Cheever. We all do.
Don't talk to anyone. Don't touch anyone. Stay away from other people.
Get back in your car.
We're not sick!
It's figuring us out faster than we're figuring it out.
It's mutated.
How absolutely hot does that look?
That looks amazing. And the cast, the fucking cast.
I know.
There's just so many people in that film that look amazing.
Like all Steven Soderbergh films. Where did it come from? I didn't even know he was making it.
No. I love him, man. He just runs along his career and just throws shit at you.
Now, apparently, he's just this is going to be...
Here's a new movie.
This apparently is going to be one of his last, though. He's retiring.
Really? Dude, if you go out on that...
He said a while ago that he's just finished.
Hmm.
I remember hearing Kevin Smith talking about it because he was saying, you know, how he's going out as well. Mm. He said, and Soderbergh said the same basic thing. He said that, you know, he's just kind of done.
No.
He wants to go off and fish and do other things now.
He's been around a long time.
Yeah, for like a week or two and then they'll be back. Seriously, directors don't give up. They just
I think Kevin Smith is out. I think once.
Yeah, but Kevin Smith has something else to do.
That's right. He's
life.
Got another creative output and he's moved on. I think he'll really hit somebody and then just continue podcasting. Mm. Unless, here's the bigger trick though with Kevin Smith. And I love the man. As everybody knows, I love this man. But here's a big trick. If he actually removes himself completely from the entertainment industry, will his relevance disappear?
Mm.
And if his relevance starts to go down, his numbers start to go down, his podcasting isn't so successful, he may have to come back.
Mm.
Depends on how strong his audience is just for him.
Mm. Yeah, and I think it's the same argument with the geek thing. I think he's got a core audience, but they're not enough to get the big numbers. And that's been the problem with all of his films.
Mm.
I remember years ago him complaining that none of his films would break 30 million ever. Mm. And I think Dogma at the time had been his most successful box office one, possibly.
Yeah, I think it still is, I think.
Possibly. And you know, let's face it, with the exception of Cop Out, which was designed to be a bit bigger box office.
Yeah, and Cop Out made money. There's no doubt about that. It was a terrible film, but it was a commercial film. It wasn't a Kevin Smith film.
No, and Red State won't make that kind of money.
Although Red State has a chance. Now,
Red State has a chance, but it won't make the kind of money because horror films haven't really ever made massive, massive amounts of money.
Yeah, but if he turned around with Red State and made $50 million at the box office,
well, yeah,
then something. That film, because it's already in the black now, he's already made his budget back now. So when he finally does hit wide release and puts that out, I think it's October he's released.
Oh, internationally he might make it.
And internationally, this film has the potential of being his biggest film to date just because it has so much exposure. Everybody's talking about it, you know? So I think the conversation is there to make this film.
The thing is, with Smith, he knows how to use the internet to his benefit.
Yep.
He does that really well, and he was one of the very early adopters. He had the Viewerskew website up.
Oh, the message boards.
Boards back up in the late 90s. When, you know, not a lot of filmmakers were, you know, directly involved.
Well, that's one of the things he's always said is he said people sit there and they put out all this marketing for his films. He never understood spending $20 million on marketing for his films because his audience is already, his audience already knows about the film.
Absolutely.
And most people aren't his audience. So it was always pointless for them to spend that much money.
I mean, I think there'd been some real shame. Something like Chasing Amy should have been everywhere.
Yeah.
You know, that was a beautiful film. And, you know, it was, can you compare it to the rom-coms that are in the cinema?
Chasing Amy and Dogma both deserved.
Dogma really deserved. Dogma never would have done it because of the religious content. That's always going to hold it back. It might hold Red State back as well.
Although controversy can also breed box office.
Absolutely.
And he's doing something pretty controversial with Red State.
Oh, yes.
So he's having a go.
No, I'm looking forward to Red State. I think I've got faith in that. Yeah, I think he is, like him or hate him, he's trying something different.
And this is really not Kevin Smith. This is a very different Kevin Smith.
Did he write this as well?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So that'll be interesting.
Yeah, so it's not View Askew Universe, it's not Zack and Miri, it's not gross out comedy. This is him going in a completely different direction.
Which is probably what he needed to do.
Yeah.
Whether this sinks or swims, I think if he comes out on it, the other side, he'll be a better creator as a result of
it. And then with Hit Somebody, he's doing, I think once again, I think he's doing drama more than he's doing comedy because it's about, you know, hockey players and so forth.
It's interesting because all the other people he's fostered, and if you've been a View Askew fan for a while, you'll know there are a few other directors that he's had under the View Askew label. It's not just his films, and there's been things like Drawing Flies, I think, was one of the films, and I'm trying to remember some of the other ones, but there was one that was basically a very intimate, almost Stand By Me type drama, and you know, he's obviously got an affinity to that. I mean, he fostered Good Will Hunting. You know,
let's remember that Jersey Girl, for all of the bagging that Jersey Girl got when it came out, is actually not that bad a film.
I'll defend Jersey Girl. I mean, in a way that he never did. He dumped it as soon as he got some bad criticism.
Yeah, I think Jersey Girl was actually very good. And you sit there and you watch it and you go, watching it in hindsight now, looking back on it, you sit there and go, this is a very personal film. This is a bittersweet comedy drama about a single father raising his daughter and trying to cope. And it's got some really funny moments in it. There's no real gross-out humor in it at all. It's a very personal
and
story.
And it's got George Carlin.
And George Carlin doing a great job. And you sit there and you look at it and go, it's so different from everything else he had done up to that point. The flack was, this isn't Kevin Smith. And that was the biggest
issue. And it
probably
came from his audience more than it came from... And as you're right, if his audience is that online community and they want...
And he also suffered heavily from the Bennifer thing, which was so funny because she's not even in the film.
That's
She's she dies in the first 3 minutes of the film. And yet, that was what people focused on.
And he followed that up immediately with Jane, Silent Bob Strike Back. Is that right?
I think so. Yeah, he came back to View Askew.
Oh, no, was it Clerks 2 after that? Maybe. I think it was Clerks 2.
Actually, it was Clerks 2. Yeah,
Jane, Silent Bob.
Yeah, because he said Jane, Silent Bob was the last View Askew.
So Clerks 2 was good. But then that was a much more mature film than any of his other View Askew films as well. It was a real thing.
He was
thing
trying
for,
to grow up through the only way he knew how, which was through his visual.
Absolutely.
Work.
And it was for guys my age who kind of were in their early 30s watching that, or late 20s, early 30s, going, I've got to start doing
this. I'm one of the few people that really, really sort of enjoyed Clerks 2, and one of the main reasons I completely felt at home with it because I'm of that generation. I'm of that generation of people that get to 30 and go, shit, what am I doing with my life?
Absolutely. And I think there was a really cathartic moment at the end of that film because it was, for those of us who'd watched the first Clerks, or Clerks if you prefer, going all the way through.
American film we should call Clerks.
We'll call it Clerks.
Yeah.
For those who've watched it, I can't do it.
The reason why I say that is because I had a huge fight with my literature teacher when I was in high school. Side note, sidebar. So when I was doing literature in year 11, we did the Grapes of Wrath.
Grapes of Wrath.
This is exactly what she said, and I was started to read because we were reading it in the class, and we were doing passages, and I got to me, and I started to read it, and she goes, "No, dear," I had a really stuck up literature teacher, Miss Boston, I hate you. Anyway, and she goes, "No, dear, it's Grapes of Wrath," and I went, "This is a seminal classic of American literature, and I'm sure John Steinbeck said Wrath."
Yeah,
and she just looked at me like, "How dare you?" But she never corrected me again because John Steinbeck wrote the book.
Absolutely.
And it's like when you say Star Trek II, you say Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, because it's an American film. Absolutely. And that's how they would have said
it. Okay, from this point onwards, I will pronounce it Clerks.
Thank you.
In honor of our American cousins.
Just so that we don't end up with more trouble from him, really, realistically.
Do you know, Mike, a lot of you don't realize this. A lot of you don't realize this, and I keep coming back, so I don't know why, but he hits us.
Yeah.
After the show, it's kind of one of the things. Like he said, if you want to be on the show, and like I know it's good for you guys as well, you know, you have to go on the hitting cage.
You can't see him hitting anyone.
I don't hit anybody.
Come on.
All right, we've sidetracked ourselves completely there. Contagion.
Sorry, what are we doing?
Going to see it?
Yeah, of course.
Can't wait.
Day one.
All right, probably Josh and Richard. Day one.
Yes.
I have not seen the film, and this is one of the ones Josh and I have talked about. I want to see this film so bad. Yep. I just, for some reason, haven't gotten to it. Old Boy
is getting
remade as an American remake. Now, it's disturbing me that Spike Lee is directing it.
Now, can I feel this one first?
Yeah, go for it.
For two reasons.
Oh, yeah, I think that's really good. That's a good idea.
I've got two main points on this. One, I want to start because some of you might know, I do a lot of work with the Korean Film Festival in Australia. So I've been following the story very closely.
Yeah.
Old Boy is Park Chan-wook film, and it's a seminal film. It's the middle part of his Vengeance trilogy, sandwiched by Sympathy for Mr. Vengeance and Sympathy for Lady Vengeance. All fantastic films. Old Boy, first of all, when I heard Old Boy was going to be remade, the first thing I thought was, how the hell are they going to do that twist ending for America?
Yeah.
Because that's one thing. Second of all, I thought, well, they're going to have to tone this down. I mean, this is a movie where someone eats a live octopus as well. It's a fantastic film. My thing with remakes, and what we were talking a bit about this before the show, was that, you know, I'm only going to complain about remakes the second that they start burning originals and we no longer have those available to us. In fact, 9 times out of 10, this will actually make a really good quality print of Old Boy, the original, available, you know, in US stores, which it's been out there for a while, but it'll bring it back into the mainstream. So if that means more exposure to the original, fantastic.
Great.
Now, Spike Lee, getting Spike Lee on board this, it could be a really good thing. Now, lest we forget, The Departed, by Martin Scorsese, is a remake of Infernal Affairs. Yep. We all thought, no way, don't do that.
I still prefer Infernal Affairs, though.
Sorry?
I still prefer Infernal Affairs.
But The Departed is an excellent film. Mm. And there are a lot of excellent films that are remakes. So the fact that it's a remake, I'm not going
to
write it off.
We also have to remember with Spike Lee. Now, I'm not a big fan of Spike.
You be careful what you say
here. All right, no, I'll be careful what I'm going to say here, but I'm not a big fan of Spike Lee in the last 10 years. But I was incredibly impressed by Do the Right Thing when it came out. I mean, Do the Right Thing when it came out was an amazing exercise.
Careful what you say, we'll burn down your stool.
It was an amazing film that really captured the heat of the heat wave.
Yeah.
The performances were amazing. It had a lot to say. It was a very angry film.
Yeah.
By a very angry young man.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Absolutely.
No, but
the problem is, though, that
he never grew up.
Well, he's gotten older but never grew up. And he's also not that angry anymore. He's a rich guy who really doesn't have, but
it's this whole kind of it's so incredibly, what's the word I'm looking for here? It's so incredibly passive aggressive now. Mm. Like all of this passion and power and fury that he used to have in his movies, and that I didn't even like back then because it was just such an FU statement.
But I saw Do the Right Thing first run cinema though.
There was a very
different feeling about that film.
Hey, dude, I'm not disrespecting him for that, and I'm not disrespecting him for his message, because his messages were out there and powerful. But I didn't like the way they were put out because they were really anti other culture. It was this real kind of like fuck you for everything, and there was no kind of like edge to it. It was just fury. And I can deal with that because that's a person's vision and I can deal
and
with that.
And at the time, in context with when it was made,
absolutely,
he had a reason.
He was a rebel. He was an absolute rebel, and I have no problem with that. What I hate now is this passive aggressive version of it where it's not fury or anger. It's a side comment quietly in the background.
And as I was saying, what I felt about Spike Lee is not even the passive aggressive. I felt like he's not that angry young man anymore. He's kind of wealthy and content in life, but he still puts on that angry young man.
And that's what I mean. Yeah. It doesn't come across real. It comes across really kind of like, I'm saying this because I know that that's what people want from me. And it's like the scene, though funny in Inside Man, was completely unnecessary.
I was gonna say, how can you take the man's... So the problem is, I have a problem taking Spike Lee seriously now because he goes off and, you know, makes his big statements and then goes off and directs Taco Bell commercials. You know, and you sit there and go, I have a problem with where your moral stance is at this point. You know, and that's the problem. So, yeah.
He speaks for it. Look, and honestly, I am enraged by this concept because it's like Spike Lee, even Inside Man, it's like Inside Man is a good film, but after watching it again... And again, I like it less and less the more I watch it. Like, it's actually the film that it's the twist.
I think the turning point for him was Malcolm X.
Yeah. Have you guys seen a movie called The 25th Hour?
Yes.
Yeah. I've got the text up on screen here at the moment. And this is that sort of forced, angry man thing where Edward Norton's character has this really long diatribe into a mirror where he's basically saying, yeah, fuck you too, fuck me, fuck you, fuck this. And I've actually got on the screen here, the guys can see this, the amount of times
58.
Fuck is used in one speech.
Yeah.
Well, that's for the page. So it's probably a good 30, 40 times it's used in this one speech. And it's this really forced, stagey kind of thing. And he's got Edward Norton to say this thing. Yeah, so it's coming out.
I remember when that film was coming out, though. I remember how the black community was mad at him because they're basically saying you sold out to the man and all this sort of stuff, you know?
You know, one thing, because he did Summer of Sam as well.
Yep.
So I think between Summer of Sam, Inside Man, and 25th Hour, somewhere in that potpourri of films and his early angry stuff, there is a good old boy in there somewhere. If he can somehow channel all those bits and pieces that he did well in those films.
Look,
I don't know if he's that clever, though.
No, I don't think he is. Because there were some great performances in those films. Like in Inside Man, Russell Crowe completely disappeared into the
I role. Actually don't think that, and I think this is the problem.
Clive Owen. Hang on. I'm thinking of a different film. Oh, no, Clive Owen. I'm thinking of a different film.
That's cool.
That did have Denzel in it. But Clive Owen completely disappeared into those roles. You wouldn't expect it from them. I mean, it's a...
I think the problem is that Spike Lee is not actually that good as a filmmaker. I think he lucks out with great moments. Like if you look at Do the Right Thing, and as I say, Do the Right Thing had a lot of impact when it came out. He rode on the success of Do the Right Thing for a long time. But if you go back and actually look at Do the Right Thing, it's not technically a brilliantly made film. It's more about the script, and it's more about the sentiment and the feeling of that film. And that was something that only he could do at that moment in time because he was really feeling that at that moment in time. I don't think he's technically that proficient as a filmmaker.
And one of the things that you really notice when you watch Old Boy is you have to kind of almost not despise, but really kind of like not feel anything towards the main character. Like you're following his story, but he's such a disgusting person that there's this part of you that never connects to him. And my problem is, so far, we have rumors that it's going to be Will Smith, which just doesn't work for me. Because Will Smith could never fill that thing. He's too charming. You can't have a non-charming version of him. It's not possible. And this is the thing. The character in the film is kind of...
Unless Will Smith is willing to commit 110% and change his image.
And that's a daring
move.
When you see this film you'll understand what
my point is, though, that we've said it before. We've had actors where we go, we did not think anything of it was possible.
Can you imagine the twist at the end of this movie? There's people who have seen it. There's a twist at the end of this movie. Imagine Will Smith turning around at that point going, ah, hell no.
No. And this is the problem, David. It's like there are things that I don't want to say live on air, but there are moments in this that it's not a matter of going outside your character. It's destroying his entire image. Because there are moments in this film that go against everything that is American. You know, those kind of things that only overseas...
And here's the trick, guys. Those will all be written out.
Absolutely.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. But this is what I'm saying. It's like, I don't... If they go a different direction, the movie loses all its impact because the impact is a shock impact. That's what happens in this film.
I think the biggest trick here is not the casting. I think the biggest trick here is going to be who writes it.
Yeah.
One
of the biggest casting rumors that I've heard for this is that Josh Brolin.
I've heard that rumor too.
Yeah.
That makes me like 1% more confident.
Mind you, that's in the same breath, apparently, as Chris Pine for RoboCop. So
I've heard that rumor too. Yes, that's right. I have heard that one too. Although anyway, Chris Pine as RoboCop would be kind of awesome.
Captain Kirk is RoboCop.
Damn straight. All right, let's lighten the mood a little and and say we got the Adventures of Tintin, new trailer. What did you think?
Thought we were going to go into John Carter.
No, I'm not doing John Carter.
I could use the term oiled man meat.
And there you go. You just got to use the term. All right, before we do Tintin really quickly, a trailer for John Carter came out. We're not going to play it in the show here, but we will put it up on the site and realbits.com. The realbits.com already has it on the site, so you can have a look at it over there. It really felt like Prince of Persia all over again. It feels like the same production designer worked on it. And it feels like it has the camp qualities that
are going to go
into Flash Gordon territory. This was a film that Robert Rodriguez was supposed to make.
Yeah.
And he backed out of it. And
did Spy Kids 4 Smell-O-Rama instead.
Oh, dear. Yes. So, all right. So now, with that out of the way, so you can go see your muscled man meat over at richardsthereelbits.com. And here's Tintin. Now, we showed the teaser for this a couple of weeks ago. Mm-hmm. Now the full trailer has come out. And I'm getting excited here, guys. I'm getting excited. I love Tintin. Here we go.
Snowy, look at this. A unicorn.
That's a very unique specimen, that is. Finest ship has ever sailed the seven seas.
How much for the boat?
It's not for sale.
You're about to walk into a whole mess of danger.
Something happened on this ship.
What secrets do you hold?
What's this? That model ship conceals a clue
to one of the greatest treasures in all history.
Good boy, Snowy. Are you going to take charge of this evidence?
Never fear, Tintin. The evidence is safe with us.
Thompson? Where are you?
Oh, well, I'm already downstairs. Do try to keep up.
He has no idea what's coming. You know the value of that scroll. I will find it, with or without your help.
Thanks, I'm Tintin, by the way.
Haddock. Archibald Haddock.
Find them.
Find them both.
Put your hands up!
You do know what you're doing, eh?
Relax. I interviewed a pilot once.
I swear!
I'll find that treasure before him.
What have you done?
I let a reef fire!
In a boat! Well, this is a fine mess.
Nobody takes my ship.
This may sound crazy, but I've got a plan.
Excellent.
Land! We're not there yet!
No! Land!
Did you hit anything?
Oh, dear. I want to then!
We can't turn back. Not now.
I really wish they wouldn't use that last shot, because that last shot is not good. That last shot was in the teaser as well, and I don't like that last shot. That last shot looks like Uncanny Valley.
Yeah, I've got to say my biggest problem is I don't buy Tintin's face. That's not Tintin. It's some weird-looking, ugly little man.
No, actually, I had a look at online. I was looking at pictures of Jamie Bell and looking at the pictures that they've released of Tintin, and they've taken Jamie Bell's face and they've morphed it with Tintin's face, so it actually looks like Jamie Bell playing Tintin. Mm. It's a very weird, and the idea of doing a motion capture is we don't have to do that. We can make it just look like Tintin. I don't know why they've made him look like Jamie Bell, but that's what they've chosen to do. I'll also to note, Simon Pegg and Nick Frost are doing, as we know, are doing Thompson and Twins.
Yeah.
Obviously, while they've been over in New Zealand, it just got announced this week that the final dwarf has been cast for The Hobbit, and it's Nick Frost playing the final dwarf. So if those who have been following the news, they've been releasing, or like literally just dribbling out these photos of the dwarves from The Hobbit all week, of like these character shots. And so we should be seeing a picture of Nick Frost soon.
Because very nice.
He has been cast. So, all right. So that's Tintin. I'm actually, I still want to see it though. I think the animation looks fantastic. As I wrote in the write-up I did on Geek actually about this trailer, I mean, realistically, you got Peter Jackson producing, Spielberg directing, you've got Weta Digital doing all the motion capture work, and these guys basically have rewritten the book on motion capture. So I've got a lot of faith wrapped up in this thing. So I'm and I really like the source material, so I'm really hoping they don't screw the pooch on this one, so to speak.
And Snowy.
And Snowy is the only character I think looks good.
And Haddock. I like Haddock.
As long as they don't screw Snowy.
I think Haddock is the most realistic looking character, like the best.
They made Thompson and Thompson look exactly like Thompson and Thompson. And that's probably one of the reasons why Tintin doesn't work, because they've made Thompson and Thompson look so much like the comic book characters.
And look, I mean, Haddock may have this huge nose now, but still the rest of his face kind of feels like Haddock.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
his acting presence is really Haddock, whereas Jamie Bell just is not working for me so far.
Yeah, just what they did with Christmas Carol with Jim Carrey.
Had that massive problem with the dead eyes. That was another thing both me and Dave had a problem with.
Christmas Carol.
Yeah.
Had Uncanny Valley going, and they worked hard on Christmas Carol. They really,
and, I really liked it.
And I liked Christmas Carol. I liked the animation. I liked what they did. I thought Jim Carrey was having a good time. But they still, it's something that Zemeckis does with his motion capture. Hadn't quite won it over.
He's very Uncanny Valley and all of his stuff. Right.
So this is why I'm wondering whether, because this is Weta's first attempt at a full length animated motion capture film, and they don't get Uncanny Valley. The stuff in Rise of the Planet of the Apes looks fantastic. Gollum looked fantastic. King Kong looked fantastic. You know, they know how to do this. Avatar, there's not a sign of Uncanny Valley in all of Avatar, you know. So my
of course they're 7 feet in blue.
Yeah, but these guys are 5 foot and you know, Caucasian. But the point is that fundamentally they're the same thing.
Yeah,
they're just 3D characters. So using exactly the same technology that you did with Avatar says that we shouldn't have Uncanny Valley in this case.
Yeah.
It seems to be something that happens as soon as you do a humanoid or human character, they seem to lose control of it. And I don't know what it is. Anyway, let's get on to our last news story and say the Evil Dead is returning. What are you guys babbling about?
We don't want to mention it on air.
Sure we do. What is it?
I actually don't know.
I actually don't know. He shot the thing and then he started mouthing, and the problem is when he mouths, I can never actually get what he's trying to say.
We're coming back to this at the end of the show.
See, look, there it goes again. Anyway. All right.
Evil Dead, the remake, has been kind of kicking around Hollywood for a long time now.
Yeah.
Now it looks like it's finally going ahead. A director has been signed.
Yeah.
Federico Alvarez is going to direct the remake of The Evil Dead, produced by Sam Raimi.
Yeah.
Last rumor I heard was that Bruce Campbell was actually coming back.
Okay.
But
hail to the king, baby.
But here's the bad part.
Yeah.
Diablo Cody is writing the script.
Right, so we're going to have Ellen Page in the lead, who's going to be a witty person that needs to find herself somewhere along the way while also being, you know,
Forget all of that. Is it going to be Jennifer's body?
Yeah.
That's what scares
me. That's a one-off. I had a problem with that.
It's like totally shotgun.
I liked Juno. I hated Jennifer's body.
But I hated Juno after I had started seeing other things she had written and done and started realizing...
What was her last film?
Diablo Cody. Well, she was working on that TV series.
That's the United States of Terror.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then maybe that's been occupying her time. But...
She's writing the new
Jason Reitman film.
Right.
I heard that. So
is that young adult or is that... She hadn't done much. She did Juno, Jennifer's Body, and then she did a couple of shorts.
If you look at one of her coming soons,
she's writing the new Jason Reitman,
young adult. It's called.
So she's writing that, and of course Jason Reitman directed Juno. So they're reuniting basically.
I just think
that the idea of her writing Evil Dead is a bad idea.
Why do we need to do it at all? Like, this one doesn't even make sense. I mean, we've already remade this into a remake of itself. That just doesn't even... That's just mind-blowing.
Is this a remake of Evil Dead or Evil Dead 2?
Is it a reimagining?
Exactly.
My problem. Is it a sequel? Is it a remake? Is it a reimagine? What the hell?
Look, if it was part four...
I'd be all for it.
That's fine. I think you know, we but don't need
Sam
it.
Sam Raimi has to direct it if it's going to be part four.
Absolutely.
It's just there is no advantage to this. We've seen this movie done twice.
I know. I had a rant about remakes before, and that was because it was somebody else. It was another film. Mm. But Evil Dead is too close to heart.
All right, so according to this, it says, here's a direct quote. It says, Sam Raimi and original producing partner Robert Tapert and Bruce Campbell, who also starred in the original franchise, are gearing up to remake their cult sensation, The Evil Dead. So it's a remake, okay? Through their longstanding Ghost House Pictures partnership, Raimi and Tapert were such instant fans of Fede Alvarez, which is his nickname, by the way, short film Panic Attack, that they set up a blind deal with the filmmaker, and through that process have attached Fede Alvarez to write and direct the film. Alvarez wrote the script with Rodo Saegis, I don't know how to pronounce his name, award-winning screenwriter Diablo Cody.
Oh, she's doing revisions.
She's currently doing revisions on the draft. Ghost House is committed to renewing the franchise and has the film on the fast track.
So all the sparkling dialogue will come from her.
Yeah, well, rewrites can really be a major issue.
Well, as we know from Joss Whedon.
Yeah. Mm. So Raimi, Tapert, and Campbell will serve as producers, blah, blah, blah. Where we got anything else? Have we got anything else on here on this about this? It doesn't actually say anything about the Campbell starring in it on this one, but this is a thing I heard. Although that could have just been a rumor started by the fact that he's one of the producers and they could have misunderstood that. Campbell is too old to be in this film.
I just can't fathom an Evil Dead film without Bruce Campbell.
No.
I mean, he is...
He's Ash.
He is Ash, and you can't undo... The same way that you said you can't have an Evil Dead film not directed by Sam Raimi.
Yeah.
It's they're inexplicably linked.
Do you know what
this
feels like? This feels
and you
like,
need Ted Raimi in there as well.
Yeah, if you remember going back to the mid-80s to late 80s, they remade Night of the Living Dead.
Yeah,
In color, produced by George A. Romero, directed by Tom Savini.
Yes,
he was the makeup man. He came in, he directed the remake, and it's a shot for shot remake. I mean, it really is just a shot for shot remake of the original film. And all I could sit there, I sat there watching, going, all the right shots are there, all the right makeup is there, but it's not Night of the Living Dead. No. It has no heart, no soul. It doesn't have Romero.
It comes back to that thing that Spielberg was saying. It's like a movie is a piece of its time.
Yeah.
And if you take it out of that context, it will never
work
the same way.
Night of the Living Dead was 1960-something, and it feels like 1960-something.
And in both of those films, Night of the Living Dead and in Evil Dead, so much of themselves went into the film. I mean, you know, I think we've spoken about this before, when on the low budget list that we did, but how much... time was spent that Raimi and his small crew spent going tracking back up to this cabin. Mm. Every spare moment they got, every weekend. It was their lives.
They were completely committed to it.
Yeah, and that shows in the whole trilogy, really.
Yeah, I agree. I think this is actually a bad idea. I think, as I say, we've seen too many remakes of classic horror films and none of them are working. Mm. I think that's the. Mm. I think the bigger takeaway here is that none of them are working. Nightmare on Elm Street didn't work. Friday the 13th didn't work. Texas Chainsaw Massacre didn't work. These are all films of their time.
Absolutely.
And they don't work as remakes at this point. They're just. They feel like these bad carbon copies that don't quite work within this current generation. And Evil Dead is just. And The Fog was another one that didn't work. You know, it's like we've seen so many Halloween. You know, we've seen so many of these that have now been remade over this last decade, and none of them.
Assault on Precinct 13, James just brought up.
That's not a horror film, but yes, exactly
well,
the same thing.
Well, no, but there's still horror elements to it.
Yeah,
but yeah
just not working. Leave these things alone. Assault on Precinct 13. Is a great example, actually, because it was a thing of 1974 or whatever it was when it came out. That whole thing about the gangs, the closing of police stations, everything about that film was a moment in time.
I have to quickly mention this. There's a line in Scream 4 where one of the characters is asked to name the remake of the groundbreaking horror movie in which the villain, and she quickly lists all the remakes she can think of. She goes, Halloween, Texas Chainsaw, Dawn of the Dead, Hills Have Eyes, Amityville Horror, Last House on the Left, Friday the 13th, Nightmare on Elm Street, My Bloody Valentine, When a Stranger Calls, Prom Night, Black Christmas, House of Wax, The Fog, Piranha. It's one of those, right? Right?
Actually, out of that, that's a great list, because out of that entire list, the only one that I can actually honestly say that I really enjoyed as a film was Piranha.
I was going to say Dawn of the Dead. I actually really...
I much prefer the original. It's funny, because I actually, when I watched Dawn of the Dead, I went...
I don't want to say I preferred it over the original. I wouldn't go that far, but it's a damn good film by itself.
Damn right.
Yeah, I actually watched Dawn of the Dead, and the problem I had, and Josh and I have talked about this many times, I just felt it didn't have the same soul as the First Dawn. First Dawn of the Dead is actually a really special film, and when you watch it, it's not just a horror film. It's there's a lot going on with what Romero was doing. Snyder's film doesn't have any of that. It's just a zombie flick.
It's a zombie flick, but look, it's probably the best Snyder's ever been. I mean, look, you know, 300's I hate to use the word perfect in relation to Snyder, but it is a perfect adaptation in the sense that it does that pure visual thing that Frank Miller was doing. But, you know, he's never gotten better since, and I am truly terrified at Superman.
Superman's been an ongoing thing with us for a while.
But for him at that point, I think, because it was his first feature. He didn't know any better.
I didn't mind Dawn of the Dead. I watched it and I sat there and went, it's a zombie flick. It's okay. But I mean, it came out the same year that 28 Days Later came out.
Yeah, well.
And 28 Days Later is so much better a zombie flick, you know? And so you sit there and you kind of look at it and go, it's just what it is. Whereas the first Dawn of the Dead now, still 30 years later, we sit there and go, this film is a masterpiece.
Yeah, if you want to do a list of holy shit moments, which we were talking about before.
The door kicking open?
Absolutely. Yeah.
For those who haven't seen the original Dawn of the Dead, go see it. All right, there's a scene, and it's in the first 5 minutes of the film.
Oh, yeah.
It's just one of those moments when I first watched.
There's probably about half a dozen holy shit moments.
I mean, but that moment, the door kicks open, the shotgun goes off, and you just then go, fuck!
Yeah.
So, and Dawn of the Dead's got a lot of moments like that. But, I mean, Dawn of the Dead really has something to say, and Zack Snyder had nothing to say, and that was the biggest problem with that
Absolutely.
Film. Yeah. Anyway, so I think all around, we've talked about before, as long as the original film is there, let them remake whatever they want. But at the same time, some of these are scary. Some of them are scary, you know?
And not in the right way.
Not in the right way. I mean, especially when they started doing all the Carpenter stuff. Luckily, they seem to have settled down on that now. But when they did The Fog, Halloween, and Assault on Precinct 13 all in a row like that. And now the thing, at least the thing isn't Platinum Dunes or anything, you know? At least it's getting a bigger budget and so forth. But I'd say, you just look at them and go, just leave his stuff alone. This was... Yeah. We're remaking all the stuff that was his best work.
Yeah.
You know? It's like, leave that stuff alone. If you want to remake stuff from the last 10 years.
Yeah, remake Vampires.
Yeah, that was not his good stuff. You know what I mean? It's like, leave the good stuff alone. All right, let's do our list of five. Let's talk about some good films. All right, so this week we're going to do our list of five, which is five fantastic fantasy films. It could be sword and sorcery, wizards, dragons, demons, demigods. It doesn't matter. Anything that's fantastical. Really, fantasy is a hard category. It's a hard category to pin down because, you know, people sit there and go, but that's not a fantasy film. That's a science film. We've had this debate before we started, and it's really kind of hard. So, but fantasy really is about that fantastical world where things that are unreal happen in the real world, basically. I guess you could look at it that way. I don't know. Anyway, let's start this list. And I'm just going to say straight off the bat, though, that I'm going to make a caveat on my list and say I did not include... And it's not that I don't like them. So before you start emailing me, I did not include any of the Lord of the Rings films or Harry Potter films on my list. It's a personal thing. I make a personal caveat and say, I think both series are fantastic, but I don't want to isolate any one film. So as films, I think they're fantastic. They're not on the list. Okay. All right. Let's get started. Who wants to start us?
Yeah, I'll do it.
Okay.
Because I'm typing and I'm just changing my list now.
He's just changing it, though.
Can you just like...
which one do you want me to include? Yeah. No, I actually started off with...
Since when did we start comparing lists before this?
I sort of went a little bit left field. I'm showing the guys my short list here, which was... and I think one of the things that's really important to say at the start is like fantasy, like any other genre, you can... It sort of encompasses so many different genres. You can have horror, you can have sci-fi. Yeah. And where sci-fi ended and fantasy began, I had trouble trying to find a thing. We were talking about
June, and comedy too.
And comedy as well. I even wondered whether Ghostbusters was a fantasy film.
I had one that actually bounced in and out of my list three times.
So comedy's cool, so I should put Black Knight back on that.
Absolutely.
Huh? Oh, yeah, dude. Or Spaceman in King Arthur's Court.
Yeah, absolutely. But so I've sort of bounced back and forth with a lot of these ones in here, and there's a lot of animation in there, but I thought it was unfair to put too many things. And
let me ask you one question. Yeah. Did Ralph Bakshi make your list?
No.
Really?
No, not for any reason. It's just that it's such a strong list.
Okay, I'm curious. All right, let's start us off. Number five.
Number five, I put in animation, and there's so many I could have chosen here, but I did How to Train Your Dragon.
Almost on my list many times. Yeah.
It took me completely by surprise.
One of my favorite films of last year.
And it shouldn't have taken me by surprise because I love Lilo and Stitch so much. And I think it was probably Disney's one of their few completely original creations in the last 10, 15 years. And it's mainly because of Chris Sanders. And for him to... And this it kind of completely came out of nowhere because it was a DreamWorks film that wasn't a franchise already. It wasn't a sequel, a remake, or a reboot. It was...
And the interesting thing about it was actually, in its initial release, not being financially successful.
No.
It actually came out, and its opening weekend was a really weak, and everybody thought this is going to die. And it was almost saved by this underground swell of everybody just talking. I know that the Slash Filmcast, for instance, brought it up every single week.
Absolutely.
And they're saying, you have to see this, you have to see this. David Chen, their host, was a massive fan, and basically just kept saying, they just kept hammering it over, and it just stayed in cinemas, and it just started to grow and grow, and this underground swell, and it ended up making a couple $100 million, you know.
And Chris Sanders has got this great following online. He stopped doing it for a while when he was making How to Train Your Dragon, but he's quite active online. He had an ongoing cartoon series. He's got this very distinctive style. The dragon looks almost, the main dragon looks almost exactly like Stitch in some scenes.
Yeah, the face. Yeah,
the face,
yeah.
Definitely. But he's got this very distinct sense of humour. And that he managed to get that through in this major... I mean, he managed to slip Lilo and Stitch in under the wire.
Yeah.
And Disney are loving it because it's been one of their biggest franchises in years, particularly...
Because it went on to TV series.
Absolutely. And, there's two TVs. There's a Japanese reimagined TV series of it as well, where Stitch crash lands in Okinawa instead of Hawaii. it took me by surprise. It's got... all the fantasy elements. It's got dragons.
And remarkably funny.
It is so funny. And every character is well-rounded and...
And visually spectacular.
Oh, it's amazing. Yeah. And it does all the sorts of things that is missing from animation lately. Mm. And if it hadn't been... Did it go head-to-head with Toy Story 3 in the Oscar race? I can't remember.
Yes.
If it hadn't been for Toy Story 3 coming out last year... Yeah. It would have been best animated picture for sure.
Yeah,
it was that strong.
I remember last year's Josh and I did our last year's five top films. I think both Toy Story 3 and How to Train Your Dragon made it on my list. I mean, they were both amazing films, but How to Train Your Dragon, I think, is just a fantastic film. I just loved it. It actually didn't make this list because I already had another animated film, and I was trying to go for the slightly lesser known. So I was going.
I did the same thing as well,
but I concur. I think it is a fantastic. If you haven't seen it, go see it.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Josh, your number five.
My number five is Masters of the Universe.
Yeah, baby!
And I don't give a shit what people think. And I know that people don't like it. I'm fine with that. It doesn't change anything in my eyes because realistically, I have a ball every time
and
I watch that
And this is why
film.
It is actually on my gloriously wonderful bad list.
Oh, dude.
Because it is
I
so sensationally bad fun.
I am in tears every single time I watch that film. Like, I'm just rolling around on my couch and I can't think of a more appropriate way to enjoy a night than just sitting there being like, he just looks so stupid. What is he even doing there? And it's just every
and
time.
And then to add that whole 80s twist of the music and, you know, it's just so bad.
Sure, it's just a mess and I love it.
Golden and Globus. Power on, man.
Yeah, I caught it again recently on cable, and I'd forgotten the back half of that film, it's brilliant.
And what's so great is if you watch it with the audio commentary turned on, the director is so like, yeah, that didn't work, and yeah, that wasn't so good. He fired his DOP actually partway into the production because he wanted to have, you know, it has some scenes of really bold colors and really comic-y and so forth. That's what he wanted, and the original DOP that he hired just wouldn't do it. He was saying, no, but that looks stupid. And he's like, but that's what I want. He goes, no, but that looks... So they fired him. And so there's scenes in it which are actually kind of muted. And he actually says in the audio code, he goes, yeah, this was shot by the other guy. This is shot by the new DOP. This is shot by the other guy. All the way there. And then at the end, he's going, yeah, we ran out of money at this point. It's like, you know, it's the best audio commentary. It really is.
It's so interesting that we've spoken about Transformers before, that it and this were both big 80s cartoons that just...
They were just based on toys, yeah.
Toys, and they completely failed in their live action. Transformers didn't fail financially, but I mean...
Yeah, well, Master
critically,
Universe was just a...
Yeah, a complete disaster from where to go, but it's... It's interesting that they just can't get those things right.
I mean, what I think is interesting is that this is one film that I want to see remade because they've talked about the remake of this forever. And for some reason, they cannot get the remake off the ground.
And it would be perfect. I mean, I think they're doing it in John Carter, but... but yeah.
That film's going to be amazing. I don't know what's wrong with you guys.
No. Don't get me wrong. I'm keen for it.
John Carter. I'll get that trailer up this weekend, I promise. All right, my number five... Josh, I love you for that one. It's a gloriously wonderful bad list. I love it. My number five is actually Ralph Bakshi cartoon. Ralph Bakshi did the animated Lord of the Rings, as we know. Mm-hmm. Followed Lord of the Rings, actually, with a film called Fire and Ice, which was done with the same rotoscoping style, but all the design, character designs, was all done by Frazetta, the artist who did all the Conan covers. So it's got this really great look, and it's basically just a tale of a barbarian saving a princess and blah, blah, but it's kind of Bakshi's style. But unlike Lord of the Rings, it actually has a beginning, a middle, and an end. So you can actually sit and watch this, and it's a really, really good animated fantasy film, just Dungeons and Dragons style. You know, it's a lot of fun. Sorry, and I see Dolph Lundgren on your screen. Speaking of oiled muscle. Fantastic. All right, you're number four, Richard.
Oh, we'd be back to me already.
Yeah, we're back to
me. My number four is...
Stop looking at Dolph Lundgren.
But he's so oily and man-meaty. Is the one, the only, the Neverending Story.
Yeah, it almost went on my list three times.
Can we all sing the song? No, we won't sing the song.
Never ending.
Don't have time.
I was a fan. I remember reading the book several times as a kid, watching this movie over and over. It's such a perfect kids' film as well, because it's like was it the grandfather reading the book to the kid, and who's reading the story, and they're all involved. There's all these levels, and you feel as though you're involved. You are. That's kind of like one of the twists. By the end of the film, you know, we were there the whole time, and it's just the whole idea.
It's actually a great book.
It's a great book, and it's the whole idea. It's so meta. It's the idea. It's way ahead of its time, and it's like, you know, the watcher watches the watcher watches the watcher. You know, the stories live on.
And then they went on and destroyed it by making four sequels.
Absolutely,
which they really didn't.
Which
need
you
to
ignore completely because it's got. I mean, Falcor still looks pretty damn good, actually.
Yeah, I mean, some of the matting is a bit rough, but I mean, that's the 80s, you know, that's 80s, the way it looked.
But the Blu-ray came out recently, and it still holds up pretty well.
I saw it at the cinema back in the day, and I actually really enjoyed it. I thought it was a really good film. It's got the kind of strange European flavor to it because of Wolfgang Petersen directing it's a good story. It really is really nicely designed.
And I tell you what, no matter how many times I see it, the scene with the horse in the swamp.
Yes.
Tears every time.
Yeah, actually, in fact, Celine brought that up at one point in one of our lists, that very scene.
Yep, it is universally appealing.
Yeah, Josh, your number four.
Conan the Barbarian.
I'm going to hold comment because I actually have it higher on my list.
I know, I know. And I will leave it at that.
All right, cool. We'll come back to that one. Okay, my number four is the 1963 Don Chaffee film Jason and the Argonauts, which I felt we really needed to have a Ray Harryhausen on this list. And for me,
I almost put on...
one of the Sinbads?
Yeah, but no.
I just think Jason and the Argonauts is one of the absolute key films in this genre. This was the film that introduced the whole concept of the sword fighting against the skeletons, and you know, and it was just so groundbreaking in its day that, I mean, I've watched Jason and the Argonauts so many times. I just love this film. I love Harryhausen and what he did with animation, but this film in particular was this beautiful combination of the stop motion and the live action. And this is really, this was the film that you could look at and go, this is the grandfather of the original Clash of the Titans. You know, this is above all the Sinbads, unfortunately, the problem I had with, I've got all the Sinbad films. I love Sinbad, right? And there's, you know, the Seventh Voyage Sinbad and so on. But they're all kind of cheesy, whereas Jason and the Argonauts doesn't quite feel as cheesy. It feels like its story is a little bit more grounded. So I think that's why it stands out a little bit more for me. But I really like that. I really like the 62. And I'm curious to see... there has been talk about a remake of this film. So I would be very curious to see what's done. I know that Bryan Singer is working on Jack the Giant Killer, which is another one that I really liked from the day. So be curious to see what he does with that as well. All right, your number three.
I put this here and I just thought of another one that I could have put in its place, but Excalibur.
I'm going to hold comment because mine's higher up.
Yeah. John Borman film. I'm starting to wish I'd put Monty Python and the Holy Grail there.
I thought about that one. I actually thought about, there's two comedies I thought about. I didn't put either of them in the list, but there are two that could have gone on.
Excalibur. When I was a kid, anything Arthurian was, I just devoured. And when I saw Excalibur, and it was 81, so I wouldn't have seen it then. I would have been a little too young for it, but... It's a very adult telling.
Certainly is,
and it's what Arthur deserves, and I've appreciated it so many times. I think you find more in it every time, and like you know, Helen Mirren at her finest, and but everything about it is great. It gets the Arthurian legend down perfectly. That whole mysticism that's wrapped up in it. It deals with incest.
Yeah, I'll come back and talk a little bit about it when I come back to it. It's actually much higher on my list because for me, it's a personal favorite.
Yeah,
and I actually saw it about 8 times at the cinema.
Wow.
Back in 81. It was a forbidden fruit as well, because you got to consider when it came out, I was only 13 or 14.
Right. Yeah.
And it was only rated M, but it had boobies and it had blood and it had gore. And it was like, this was a film where at 14 years old, you went, this is amazing, you know, and we have to see this. And then over the years, I've seen it many times since, and I own a copy downstairs, and I want it on Blu-ray, which I've only got it on DVD, but I want it on Blu-ray. And this is, for me, it is the perfect telling of the Arthurian legend.
Absolutely.
And all films based on King Arthur, I compare to Excalibur. Mm. And it's bad because I sit there and I go, because it is a telling of Le Morte d'Arthur by Malory.
It is.
It's going right back to that original source.
Yeah, if you read Le Morte d'Arthur, which I did as
which
a kid.
Which I did, too. I did read it as a kid. I actually read it more recently than that. And I've also got it on audiobook. And it's long.
So do I.
It's long. Yeah. And it's complicated. And Excalibur is only a very small portion of the whole telling of this story.
But all the key bits are in there. And look, who can forget the score?
Oh, and all the amazing use of classical music and the Trevor Jones stuff that was inserted in between. We'll just skip to the chase and basically say that it's number one on my list.
Okay.
So it's coming up. I'll talk about it more. I won't talk about it more later. I'll just say it here, that this is a film that needs to be seen.
Absolutely.
And yes, there are some campy performances in it, and some of it doesn't quite gel now.
That goes with the genre, though.
But it goes with the genre, but it also goes with the time that it was made. And Borman also is very theatrical in his style, so everybody speaks in proclamations.
But was the casting as well. Yeah. I mean,
it was all Shakespearean actors. We've got Patrick Stewart in there,
Nicole Williamson,
who is quite frankly the best Merlin ever put on screen.
Brilliant.
A very
young Gabriel Byrne was in there.
Yeah, absolutely, and a very young Liam Neeson. And as Bors, you know, there's some great characters, some great work in there, and it's a fantastic film. And it's one of those films where you sit there and you just let it just wash over you.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, and never a better use.
It is. It's a good work because it's a very dreamy movie as well.
Mm. Yeah,
and it's shot with that kind of
green filtered lights and all this. And I mean, beautiful design on Excalibur, the sword itself, and the fact that it goes. This is a really, I mean, the Arthurian tale is a really dingy, dark, sordid tale. And Borman said, if we're going to do dingy, dark, and sordid, let's go all the way.
Yeah.
And basically, he's got the incest in there. He's got knights pounding on girls.
It basically begins with a rape.
Yeah, I mean, you've got Egrain being raped by Uther while he's still wearing full armor.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, and he's just pounding on her in her little frail naked body. And he's thinking, this is just mean. In every way, this film could be mean. And it's dark. And don't watch it on TV. Channel 10 has shredded it.
Yeah.
And I've seen it on TV a couple of times. And it's shredded every time you see it. See it on DVD.
Absolutely.
Watch it. And just accept what Borman was doing. Borman was trying to make as realistic a spin on what is a really fantastic story, you know?
And he
did a very good job.
It's a damn near perfect version of it.
I think so. And that's why when things like Mists of Avalon have come out, I sit there and go, this is just not Arthur. I can appreciate what she was trying to do with these stories.
That was Marion Zimmer Bradley.
That's right. And they made a miniseries of it not long ago.
That's right.
And I watched it and I sat there. I haven't read the book, but I sat there and watched the miniseries.
I
just went, this isn't. My wife loves the book.
The book's very touchy. It's very that sort of.
That's a feminist.
Feminist retelling.
Yeah, it's a feminist re envisioning of the whole thing. But you sit there and go, it's such a fantastic fable that you don't really need to mess with that. You know, you just go with the fable.
We spoke of the hero's journey before. It's perfect. Yeah.
So we'll come back to the fact that it's my number one, but that's my spiel on it. It's fantastic and well worth having a look at. Your number two. Who's number two? Your number two.
Three.
You're number three.
Still on three.
Oh, still on three. So I've skipped a few. You're number three, Josh.
My number three is Krull.
Ah, yes.
Yeah, look, I mean, it's a...
That's the other Yates, isn't it? Isn't it Peter Yates? That directed that one?
Let's have a look.
Not related to it.
Yeah. Look, it's just fun. It was one of those stories. I mean, I probably look at it more fondly because I was a kid, but it's just that absolute...
How good am I?
Yeah.
It's that absolute trip-out-ness.
It is, and the use of that one lens he uses whenever he shows the monster and it all looks like a flat plane, it's bizarre. You know,
It's crazy, and you've just got, like, you've got everything you can imagine. You've got crazy creatures, you've got, you know, bizarre things, characters, everything, and it's...
I remember seeing it at the cinema back in the 80s. There he is.
Dude,
I remember seeing it at the cinema back in the 80s and sitting there watching it going, am I watching Star Wars or am I watching fantasy? There's the most bizarre mix of science fiction, and they've got like stormtroopers walking around, but then there's guys with their swords and you see
that bizarre weapon that he's got with the thing.
Best stop motion animation spider ever put on film. That crystal spider is awesome. Just an amazing sequence.
Yep, there it is there. Yeah, no, that thing was creepy and awesome at the same time.
It's been years since I have to go back and revisit it.
It's funny because I watched it about a month and a half ago, 2 months ago, because I was watching for the list. And it's really interesting because it's actually cringeworthy dialogue in places. Totally. You sit there and you watch it going, ee! And then something really great happens and you go, oh! And then you go, ee! And you go, oh!
It's a great experimentation of a film. Yeah. It's just like, it's all these awesome concepts.
It was England trying to create a big fantasy film to compete with America's...
And they failed miserably. But you know what? They tried really hard, and that's what I hang on to.
The other film that came out at the same time, I remember seeing at the cinema as well, was a film called Hawk.
There's one of my favorite websites ever was a website called badmovies.org.
Yeah.
And they break down every film, things I learned from this movie, stuff to watch out for, etc. And I love one of their things, and one of their big things is random act of violence. 16 minutes into Kroll, you get random act of violence against a hay cart.
Fantastic. All right, we got to move on. We're running really late here.
Yes, we are.
All right, me, three. Jim Henson, Frank Oz, 1982, The Dark Crystal.
Come back to that.
Number two.
My number two is The Wizard of Oz.
Oh, I love it. I didn't even think it was. You know, it's funny. You don't even think about it.
Full credit of this should go to the lovely Susan, my girlfriend.
Yep. The lovely Susan.
To use her full title. She suggested this last night. What about The Wizard of Oz? I think, what about The Wizard of Oz?
What about The Wizard of Oz?
So wherever the Wizard was, The Wizard of Oz is one because.
Well done.
Thank
sir.
You.
All right, no, I will give you full credit. It's when you're doing these lists and you hear other people's lists, you sit there and go, why didn't I even I didn't even think of The Wizard of Oz?
Well, neither did I, but so, once it was mentioned.
So, Susan, well done.
Thanks, Susan.
Your number two.
My number two is Dark Crystal.
There you go. All right, so Dark Crystal. I think this is just like fantasy perfection. I mean, it was just, you know, you sit there and you look at it and you just go, nowadays it would all be done in motion capture, but they did it with puppets. It has these incredibly beautiful puppets, especially the Gelflings themselves, incredibly expressive, great story. I am curious to see the sequel that is supposed to be coming out at some point.
Yeah.
I don't think it's necessary. The film wraps up. It is, and you sit there and you go, I don't know why we're doing a sequel, but apparently they are. And isn't the sequel like the Brothers Strauss?
I've heard this.
Or something like that, which is a real issue with me because they're not very good.
You know, the only reason this isn't on my list is because it's been so long since I've seen it. And I did have this in Labyrinth shortlist too, because I think they came out around the same time.
They came out about 2 years apart.
Yeah.
And I think Labyrinth, for me, is actually the weaker of the two, but I know there are a lot of people who think it's the better of the two.
Even though it's got old Bowie in there, but it's also got
Jennifer Connelly.
Absolutely. But the thing is, I remember...
Dangerous Jennifer Connelly.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I remember being scared shitless by The Dark Crystal when it came out, and I can't remember
why.
It was a scary film? I remember it having this profound effect on
the
me.
The Skeksis are terrifying, that's why.
And you're right. I think the puppetry still works for it because it's thing. But I didn't include it in my list because it's been so long since I've seen it, and I had a few
rewatch
other ones.
Rewatch time,
absolutely.
Rewatch time. It's also on Blu-ray now, isn't it?
Yes,
I believe it's come out on Blu-ray. I think I might have to replace my DVD with a Blu-ray copy of that because it's a great film. I love it. In fact, as I say, there's the two big fantasy films from Henson were that and Labyrinth. And Labyrinth was fun, but it wasn't the Dark Crystal. Mm. So, Josh, tell me about your thoughts on the Dark Crystal. Seems it's on your list.
Look, I mean, man, I'm kind of just sitting here listening going, there's really not much more I can add. I mean, realistically, it's a great film. It's, like you say, the puppets work, and they universally will always work because everything fits the kind of dimension. Mm. It was when they just had the style. And you know how they were building it for years.
Was it Brian Frowned? Was that his name? Frowned, who did all the production design on that? Mm. And it was amazing. His design was just staggering. I remember when the film actually came out at the cinema. When it came out at the cinema back in the, when it came out in the 80s at Meyer Melbourne, where I was living at the time, they brought all the puppets over and they had an exhibition of the Dark Crystal like in the basement, and you could go there and wander around and look at all the swords and the puppets and everything else, and they were so good. Beautiful close up. Well, look, the Skeksis actually were taller than a human. Mm. They were huge puppets, you know? And it's just amazing to see them.
Well, the thing that was, in my opinion, it's when Jim Henson hit perfection with the puppets. Yeah. It's like he had been doing it for so long, and you could tell he was building towards something.
Yeah, and they weren't Muppets anymore.
No, they weren't. And it was him really wanting to tell something a bit more adult, a bit more sort of, you know, controlled. He wanted to give it a bit more expression because he was stuck within these characters he had designed. Like, he kept creating, like, a Muppet that, you know, and they were all hairy, and it was difficult for him to really kind of, like, create something that was a bit more than that.
Yeah.
And this is exactly what he managed to do with this film.
What have you found?
Someone in the chat room, Charlie Fats, said, "Return to Oz," off the back of My Wizard of Oz, and I think there's actually a good line through from some of these films, because it uses a lot of the same kind of, it has got the very same dark kind of approach to it.
That was
it
the,
uses puppetry.
What was her name?
Fariza Balk.
That's the one. Yes, Fariza Balk.
And I thought that was an interesting one. I'd completely forgotten about Return to Oz. I wouldn't have included both Wizard of Oz and Return to Oz.
I haven't seen Return to Oz in a million years.
Nor have I, but I remember, again, it was one of those ones that I found frightening as a child.
Course, I saw it at the cinema, and I don't think I've seen it since. So I must
It's kind of like a weird cross between Neverending Story and The Dark Crystal.
Yeah. I remember that. I remember it being very dark. All right, so that was your number two, right?
Mm-hmm.
My number two is Conan the Barbarian. You had Conan the Barbarian earlier, didn't you?
Yes.
Yeah. Look, I don't know what you want to say about Conan the Barbarian, but all I'm going to say about Conan the Barbarian is, from me personally, at its time of release,
I think that's almost vaulted with you, Dave.
I think it is vaulted with me. This is a film where you sit there and go, this film succeeded in perfectly doing exactly what it set out to do. It wanted to make the ultimate barbarian movie, and John Milius set out to do that with a script by Oliver Stone, and I think he successfully pulled off the perfect barbarian movie. And it's been tried even by the same people with Conan the Destroyer, and then it was tried with the Scorpion, and they've all failed. John Milius' original Conan just works.
Absolutely.
And I think it's perfectly succeeds in doing exactly what it set out to do, which was to be Conan. And this is why I think the remake of Conan doesn't work for me. And I'm very curious to see it, because I just don't think it's going to work. So,
curious.
Yeah, curious. Josh, thoughts?
Nope, that's it, man.
Yeah, okay, there you go. Moving on. So that was my number two. That's your one.
My one. Well, for
me, we're going to make it fast. We're running real late here.
For me, one, there can be only one. Is Highlander.
Oh, God. Okay. I don't think Highlander would go on a list for me. Well, I like Highlander.
Again, it's one of those ones. It's a personal favorite.
Yeah.
And,
absolutely.
I've spoken about this before. It's,
although, if Josh can put Master Universe, you can put Highlander.
Absolutely. From the dawn of time, we came. Through the shadows. No one ever known we were among you until now. Look, I mean, it's got everything. It's got Sean Connery as a Spanish.
Spanish-Egyptian,
that's right. Spanish-Egyptian.
And it's got Lambert as a Scot.
Absolutely. Juan Sanchez Villalobos Ramirez. I love everything about it. I love Russell Mulcahy's direction in it. I love the transitions that he does. It's that music video vibe.
Absolutely. The one thing I give that film is, for me personally, it's Mulcahy's best film, and in the sense of just being purely creative.
And it's got the sword fights are great. The fantasy elements are great. I love the idea of immortals fighting through time. I mean, to me, that story is great. And it spawned, what, 3 or 4 sequels?
And a TV series.
And two TV series, because there was The Raven as well.
Yeah.
And you know, they were all kind of good. And,
except for Highlander 2.
Except for Highlander 2.
Highlander 2 is a really awful film.
Even the Renegade.
No, man, I'm sorry. There are some great lines in that. The bit where they're sitting in the infirmary and pulling out the bullets and having the conversation about who got shot more. Amazing.
But you know what? You know why Highlander 2 doesn't work? It's because it crosses over into sci-fi, and Highlander works best as, this list would imply, fantasy.
Agreed. All right, your number one, Josh?
My number one is Labyrinth. I'm sorry, but as far as it goes with fantasy, it is my favorite film. Namely, because David Bowie's in it. But apart from that, look, I mean, it's just like you said, when you think,
it comes down to a personal thing. They're Labyrinth and Dark Crystal, because they're actually kind of opposites of each other in style. And there are people who like Labyrinth more than Dark Crystal, and there are people who like Dark Crystal more than Labyrinth.
And they are very different films. And they're very different. Like, everybody's got that film when somebody says fantasy to you. Some people will think Lord of the Rings. Some people will think this. For me, it's Labyrinth. That is fantasy at its best for me. It is pure. It's the pure trip-out culture of what is that. It was the perfect timepiece for its thing. Jennifer Connelly. Dangerous.
I remember watching that movie at the cinema and thinking...
I mean, it's not quite so dangerous for me because at the time I was, you know...
Okay. Yeah, I remember watching it at the cinema because I think she was 14 or 15 when she did the film.
Yeah.
And I remember looking at her thinking, oh my God, in a few years, you are going to be staggering. Mm. And I think every male in the audience is thinking exactly the same thing, thinking, slap yourself, just stop it.
You know? Four words, Requiem for a Dream.
No, I'm just going to say... I'm going to say The Hot Spot. Which is The Hotspot, which is the Don Johnson film, which is the first film where she actually took her clothes off.
Right.
And everybody went...
She does a lot more.
And everybody went, hubba hubba. Mm. And then, of course, I don't think she's ever looked better than... There was a terrible film, but she's never looked better than the film Career Opportunities, which was a John Hughes production, and which very little seen. Mm. But she spends the entire film with her hair being very seductive and her tight white top and her tight... And every male in the audience is going, oh my God, this is not a good... This is not good, you know?
Stay tuned for next week when we do our top five hot Jennifer Connelly moments.
I think so. Jennifer Connelly is, as we know, grew up to be quite sensational. And it's funny because now she's actually not that attractive anymore.
Mm.
She had this like peak period, 18, 19, 20 years old.
You hear that, Jennifer Connelly? You're losing it, babe.
She's lost it. Well, she lost all the weight, I think. And that's the problem. She had a beautiful puppy fat on her, you know? And when she got all thin and serious and took herself seriously, nobody was interested anymore. Anyway, my number one, of course, is Excalibur. We don't need to go on anymore on that. I think Excalibur is just what it is. What can I say? All right, special mentions, as I said, Lord of the Rings, Harry Potter. Didn't go on the list, but they are just great series. Absolutely. So stick with them. We got to finish the show, though, because we are so late. So let's move on. As a Richard, how can people find more about you?
They can find me in three places. They can find me at therealbits.com. That's REELbits.com, DVDbits.com, or just on Twitter, where I am most of the time at DVDbits.
Fantastic. Josh, how can I find more about you?
RawDLC.com, gaming website. Go check it out. And that's it.
Fantastic. All right, and I've got a few things to say real quickly. First of all, if you agree or disagree with anything we had to say today, send your feedback to feedback@filmactually.com, or you can send us a voicemail, 02801131367, I believe, is the number. I don't have the sheet in front of me. 3167. If you want to follow us on Twitter, personal or site, you want to buy merchandise, you want to follow our Facebook page, anything, just go to geekactually.com. All the information is there. That is our home. You can also watch this show live. If you want to come and join us live, join our chat room, and actually see us on video while we're doing this crazy, wild recording, go to geekactually.com/live. We start our recording day typically at about 12 p.m.-ish Australian Eastern Standard Time every Saturday. So come along, join the fun. It's kind of fun. We got a couple of friends we just got a shout-out to very quickly. Charlie and Brad are back. They're not the Movie Fan House anymore, but they do have their site, reboundradio.com, and they do have their new podcast, Good Day, Sir, is what it's called, which I love that name. Good Day, Sir. WeekendRonan.com is the home of the Real Junkies, R-E-E-L Junkies. It's a movie podcast like us, but they drink tequila. Find them on iTunes. They are great guys and well worth having a listen to. And, of course, Rachel over at the Funky Film Show. Love you, dear. She's every Thursday on Radio Fremantle, 107.9 FM. Or if you miss it or you don't live in Fremantle, go to RadioFremantle.com and you can check out her show. That's it. We're done. All right. Cool. Now, what we are going to do is we are going to go out, because this was the grand finale of Harry Potter, I thought we just need to go back and just play some Harry Potter music. Not necessarily from any one of the scores. This happens to come from the first one. It's John Williams. It's Hedwig's theme, which is one of the most well-known themes, I think, in the entire show. So go see more movies. You don't see enough movies. Thank you, chat room. Thank you, Richard. Thank you, Josh. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. Go see more movies. You don't see enough movies, and all of life's questions are answered in the movies. And we'll see you all next week. Bye, everybody.
See ya.